You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
So here's the thing. On a little bit before October 5th, Dick Cheney, the vice president, met with a bunch of Republican senators and said, you know, I don't like the fact that this Patriot Act is taking so long to go through Congress. He said, it's going too slowly. I want it passed. Let's try to get it through by October 5th. This is October 5th, 2001. So that's Cheney's deadline. Well, guess what? It wasn't passed by October 5th, and the two guys most responsible for holding it up were Daschle and Leahy. So then guess what? Somewhere between October 6th, the day after that deadline, and October 9th, somewhere within those 3 days, two anthrax letters are sent to, guess who? Daschle and Leahy.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show, The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. Graham McQueen taught in the Religious Studies Department of McMaster University in Ontario for 30 years. In 1989, he became founding director of the Center for Peace Studies at McMaster and oversaw the development of peace-building projects in Sri Lanka, Gaza, Croatia, and Afghanistan. He is a co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel, and was on the organizing committee of the 2011 Toronto hearings on 9/11. He is the author of The 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy. Today we discuss the intimidation of elected representatives in both the United States and Canada as a core feature of the war on terror. Graham McQueen, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here, Bonnie.
How would you describe the initial reactions of the United States Congress to explosions in the Twin Towers on September 11th?
Well, as far as I know, members of Congress specifically didn't talk about explosions in the towers, although in my opinion that's what brought them down. But certainly members of Congress reacted to the destruction of the towers and to the fact that someone rushed into their rooms where they were watching all this stuff unfold on TV and said, you got to evacuate the Capitol. You've got to evacuate the whole building because it looks like there's a plane headed our way. And according to Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle, that was the first time in history that the entire Capitol had been evacuated in that way. And there didn't seem to have been any protocol as to how to do it. He says it was, quote, total chaos with, you know, senators and House members scattering in all directions in fear. So that's why this was a major act of terror, or if you like, deliberate intimidation of Congress. Imagine them having to flee the building in which they meet. It's symbolic of the representatives of the United States population meeting together to deliberate and make laws. So, you know, regardless of whether it was explosions or something else that destroyed the towers, and we could talk about that later, this 9/11 incident certainly caused intimidation of Congress.
What is a pattern that is common in societies experiencing danger?
Well, one of the patterns that I'm drawing attention to these days, and I'm certainly not the inventor of this idea, it's been around for a long while, I use the acronym TUR, TUR, to symbolize threat, unity, and response, or as sometimes I say reaction, but let's say response. Threat, unity, and response. So in other words, some threat appears on the scene. The group or society in question is intimidated, they're frightened, and they therefore draw together. That's what unity is about. They pull together like a herd threatened by a predator. And indeed, we see this in communities of non-humans, not just humans. They draw together, and there are a lot of implications there. Civil liberties often go out the window. Dissent is often repressed. And in fact, this unity is usually a hierarchical unity, not an egalitarian unity. Hard to distinguish from obedience. So normally the executive branch of the government or the military, whoever at that point is claiming to be the leader, gets to do what they want, and everyone else huddles behind them, grateful for their protection, grateful to have security. That's what I mean by unity. And then response can be of various kinds, but I'm especially interested in two kinds. One is the repression of dissent, which I just talked about. Oh, let's pass a new law, making it more difficult for people to maintain their traditional civil liberties. Let's give more power to intelligence agencies and police and the executive branch. That would be a response that concentrates on the domestic scene, the inside of a society. The other kind of response is external or international, and that's when the society says, somebody did this to us. Some foreign agency or power or entity. So now, having drawn together as a herd, you know, and we're now strong and united, we will hurl ourselves at this external enemy. And that's usually what we mean by war. That's an act of aggression. That's armed force usually, which we then direct toward the person that we think is the enemy or that we imagine as the enemy, whether they are or aren't. So in other words, threat comes first, then a powerful unity, a herd sense, which then leads to a twofold response, both domestic and international. That's the pattern I'm interested in right now. And I'm especially interested in when it's done to the elected representatives of people, Congress, Parliament, that sort of thing.
You have written that there is a pattern common enough in war and found in the war on terror, threat, followed by unity, followed by reaction, which has an internal and external dimension, which you've just mentioned, the sacrificing of civil liberties and then outwardly attacking enemies. Could you talk about unity, particularly with regard to the United States Congress on September 11th, 2001? What signs were there immediately that Congress was, both sides of Congress, were drawing together in an act of unity?
Right. Well, after they fled in chaos and confusion from the Capitol and went in various directions, many members of Congress gathered later in the day on the steps of the Capitol outside. And there was a podium set up and speeches were made. And the typical, you know, the theme was, as political elected leaders usually say on these events, we will not be intimidated. We will stand up to this threat. We will never allow ourselves, et cetera, et cetera. And included in that were lots of statements of unity. We will gather together regardless of our typical disagreements, regardless of what party, regardless of whether we're Senate or House of Representatives, we will gather together under the President of the United States. So that's the statements of unity. And then when they had finished making these statements, and by the way, one of the speakers was Senator Tom Daschle, who was Senate Majority Leader. He's one of the few people who could have thrown a monkey wrench into the works of the Bush administration, because the Democrats actually had a majority in Senate, and he could have blocked both the resolution on the use of force, which would allow the U.S. to do warlike things, and he could have also blocked the internal act, the so-called Patriot Act coming up, at least in theory. Could have given them a lot of trouble. But there he is. He's convinced the whole 9/11 story was genuine. He's hoodwinked like most everyone else. He's standing at the podium. He's been won over. He wants to unite under the president. And in fact, Daschle says he had never experienced such a powerful sense of unity in his life as he did on 9/11. We were one big family, he said. Well, that's a classic statement of unity. And then after he's finished his speech and all the speeches are finished, they're starting to drift away. And clearly some people feel that's not enough. We need some ritual affirmation of unity. And so somehow or other in the crowd, still on the steps, the singing begins. God bless America, our home, sweet home. So I don't have any problem with the fact that they're singing it. But it's remarkable to watch because we have a record of this on video. And this is such interesting, important historical footage. In scattered little groups, they begin singing it. And on they go. And they all know the words and they all sing it. And then they hug each other and everything else. And this, again, I don't want to make fun of them. This is what human groups do under threat. They're clearly moved. They're clearly feeling unity as a family. But what I want to point out to people is that although this is very natural, there's nothing wrong with it inherently, what you're in at that point is you're in an emotional state, and the critical part of your brain isn't necessarily working really well. And in fact, if people begin to dissent and begin using their brain, begin asking questions, who the heck did this? What do you mean, Al-Qaeda? That's usually not looked upon very favorably. And so you are allowing your own brain, or if you prefer, your mind, to be disabled, if you like, to be put on hold. And that's really dangerous, because if the event, if the whole threat is a fake in some way, if it's a false flag operation, for example, where, you know, a crime has indeed been committed, but not by the perpetrator you're being told, but by someone else, you're in a very vulnerable position. You're singing, you're hugging, you're ready to throw your armed forces against the enemy, but it's the wrong enemy. And you're willing to give up your civil liberties, but it's for the wrong reason, and so on. So this is a moment of tremendous vulnerability for a population at large, but also for the elected representatives of the people.
Well, with regard to the subject of unity, I noticed that you have posted a few photographs of Daschle actually hugging President Bush.
That's correct. That was a few days after 9/11. I believe it was after a big formal church service. And, you know, photographers were snapping pictures, of course, of this, because Bush and Daschle were opponents, and they really had major ideological differences. Daschle is frank about this in his autobiography. And, you know, he was extremely critical of the way the Bush administration had come into power and begun to immediately thumb its nose at international law, for example. And yet here is Daschle. You know, he's caught up in the moment. He wants to be a good patriot. He wants to be a good leader. He wants to do what's right. He believes the 9/11 official narrative. So there he is, hugging his opponent, Mr. Bush. And I think I said somewhere or other, this is one of the most dangerous hugs in modern times, because really that meant what that symbolizes to me is the Tom Daschle, who I respect, but who proposed the resolution on the use of force, and Congress passed it almost unanimously on September 14th, and that gave cover to the Bush administration in its aggression against Afghanistan and even to some extent for its aggression against Iraq. Don't forget that the U.S. Constitution gives the power to declare war to Congress, not to the president, not to the executive branch. And even though presidents seldom seek an official declaration of war anymore, they like to have some degree of cover, some kind of sign from Congress that they're enabled to do this. And that's what they got on September 14th. So the hug with, you know, Daschle partly represents his role in that, but it also represents the fact that he was willing to support this Patriot Bill, the Patriot Act, which was, you know, introduced to Congress very rapidly after 9/11. And, you know, there's a whole other story there, which we'll maybe get into, because Daschle did put up a little bit of a fuss, and and was taken care of, we may say. But that hug, you know, when you see these hugs, that represents a very dangerous unity and a very vulnerable population.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show, The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. During times of perceived danger, how are populations and their elected representatives vulnerable to manipulation? You have written that a strong social taboo has been constructed that has hampered awareness of this deception and manipulation. What is this taboo?
Well, first of all, the business about how populations are vulnerable at the exact moment of the attack, I'm giving a very informal account of it. I'm not a psychologist and I'm not a neurologist. I'm not trying to give a sophisticated account, but basically, we get frightened by threats, and we go into a certain part of our mind where we seek reassurance, we seek unity, and the critical mind is not functioning very well. And as I've said, that's dangerous. Now, the thing is that usually doesn't last too long. So, for example, after 9/11, the poll showed that many Americans were willing to suspend their civil liberties, and they were willing to hurl themselves at the enemy. However, we know that doesn't last too long, and the polls showed that, and there was a lot of sign that resistance in the U.S., both in Congress and in the general population, was starting to grow to the Patriot Act, for example, saying, wait a minute, are we giving away our civil liberties? And it was very broad-based. It wasn't just the left. It was people on the left, people on the right, people all over the place were wondering about this, and also some rumblings of anti-war sentiment. So what happens in that case? Well, what happens is that if the executive branch is determined, as I believe it was in the fall of 9/11, to get its war and to get its civil liberties restrictions, it will do its best to maintain the sense of fear, maintain the threat, both against Congress and the general population. And I think that's quite clearly what it did in the case of the fall of 9/11. There were all kinds of reports of threats. The FBI was coming up with stuff. Oh, we're 100% sure Al-Qaeda's going to attack again.
You have reported that members of the U.S. Congress were told by the FBI not to wear their congressional pins publicly or to use their congressional license plates. They were told they must hide their identities as elected representatives. Now, I hadn't heard that before.
Yes, this is very clear. It was reported in mainstream media. And so this was what I'm calling one method of keeping Congress intimidated. You can't go out in public and tell people, right, that you are a congressional member. You might be attacked. And there's barricades around, you know, the Capitol and police tape and all kinds of additional restrictions and rerouting of traffic. All this is going on after 9/11. Then to cap it off, the FBI and Department of Homeland Security and all kinds of people start warning that, you know, there's going to be more attacks, that there's a very strong likelihood that there'll be more attacks, and they could be attacks on Congress. And oh my gosh, they start saying we could even get a biological attack or a chemical attack. And guess what? They did. You know, then the anthrax attacks begin. And then we have anthrax attacks on two U.S. senators. And so what I'm saying is I think it's very clear. My own research indicates it's quite clear that 9/11 was the big shock that created the threat, the unity, and so on. But you have to maintain that. And so the anthrax attacks were like the second punch, you know, 1-2 punch. And they kept up the momentum. They kept up the fear. They kept up the threat. You know, the senators in the Hart Senate building had to abandon the whole building. It was contaminated with anthrax. And they were trying to get the Patriot Act passed by, you know, using various offices in Washington and didn't have access to their own equipment. So under extreme sense of threat and danger, they passed that act. And this is what I'm talking about by keeping up the pressure and keeping up the sense of threat and fear, which then continually disables people's critical mind, puts them in this emotional state in which they're vulnerable.
Now, the anthrax letters were sent to leaders of Congress, specifically Daschle and Leahy, but then the media also received these letters. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Several mainstream media organizations received the letters, and they received theirs first, in fact, and there were some infections that resulted from this. There were five people who died, don't forget. A couple of them were postal workers. Actually, if you look at the anthrax deaths, it seems most, if not all of them, were quite random. These extremely dangerous, sophisticated anthrax spores were put in envelopes and sent through the mail, and there's really no way to tell who would die, but it's pretty clear somebody would. So I think it's quite clear that whoever did that wanted to intimidate the general population of the United States, because, you know, people get mail, right? And there's no way of knowing whether that mail now is going to be contaminated by anthrax. And then here are these poor people, ordinary folks, you know, postal workers, an old lady living by herself, a Vietnamese-American, I forget, nurse's aide or something, Robert Stevens, photo editor. These people suddenly are dying. Many other people are ill. And so this is intimidation of the general population. But then when you get two letters specifically used to target members of Senate who are holding up the Patriot Act, you have to go, wait a minute, what's that about?
Now, Senator Daschle and Senator Leahy were both looking at not supporting the Patriot Act until they got these anthrax letters. Is that correct?
It's partially correct. Let's first of all not portray them as great resistors. They were both, as far as I can tell, entirely swindled by the 9/11 attacks, and they both agreed that legislation such as the Patriot Act was necessary, and they had both said they were committed to getting it passed. However, they did want changes in it. Remember that Patrick Leahy was the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. It was his job to look at any legislation. It was the job of his committee to look at any legislation that might threaten the civil liberties of Americans, and to consider it in his committee and to raise objections and propose changes as necessary. And that's what he was trying to do. So what he said publicly is, I am committed to the legislation and I'm committed to working night and day to get it passed as quickly as possible. But if we don't scrutinize it and go slow, you know, and go carefully, as he put it, the terrorists win. In other words, if they're trying to attack our democracy, they'll be successful if we got our own democracy. So he was trying to slow Ashcroft down. He was trying to slow Bush and Cheney down. And he did that at a crucial moment. And his colleague, Tom Daschle, who had the very important position of Senate Majority Leader, supported Leahy. So here's the thing. On a little bit before October 5th, Dick Cheney, the vice president, met with a bunch of Republican senators and said, you know, I don't like the fact that this Patriot Act is taking so long to go through Congress. Now, of course, that's absurd because it was actually proceeding much more quickly than most legislation. But he said, it's going too slowly. I want it passed. Let's try to get it through by October 5th. This is October 5th, 2001. So that's Cheney's deadline. Well, guess what? It wasn't passed by October 5th. And the two guys most responsible for holding it up were Daschle and Leahy. This is all clear. It's all said in the Washington Post at the time. All you have to do is read the paper. So then guess what? So this is the October 5th deadline is missed because of two guys. So then somewhere between October 6th, the day after that deadline, and October 9th, somewhere within those 3 days, two anthrax letters are sent to, guess who? Daschle and Leahy. When I say anthrax letters, I mean letters that have an explicit written threat and printed inside, and they also contain spores of anthrax, highly sophisticated, weaponized anthrax, which could, in theory, kill not only these guys, but a whole bunch of other people. Now, it's not rocket science here. Cheney gives a deadline. Two guys are responsible for that deadline not being met. Both those guys and nobody else in Congress immediately get anthrax letters sent to them. Not rocket science here. Pretty obvious what's going on. The fact is the anthrax attacks were crucial in getting the Patriot Act passed. And there was also, during the anthrax attacks, a really serious attempt to not only claim Al-Qaeda did it, but to claim that Iraq had backed Al-Qaeda, and therefore it was also being used to promote war against Iraq. So these anthrax attacks were by no means trivial. They were really important in keeping up the momentum.
You have described our elected representatives as domesticated. How do you mean?
Well, domesticated, I don't remember how I used the term in the first case, but I would say this. Domesticated in two senses. First of all, when this kind of threat happens, they're told, it's okay, we will take care of you. You are, so to speak, a domesticated animal being looked after by the executive branch and the associated intelligence agencies, military-industrial complex. You don't strike out on your own here. We look after you. Domesticated in that sense, but also domesticated mentally in that they accept the limits to their imagination and to their thinking, which are imposed upon them. So, for example, it's not just the U.S. Same thing happened in my country, in Canada. A so-called terrorist event happens, and you see that the most obvious questions are not being asked. At least they're not asked publicly by members of Congress or members of Parliament. They may talk about it over coffee. They may know more than they let on. But at least publicly, even when the two senators who were in the best position to hold up the Patriot Act, those two and nobody else in Congress suddenly get anthrax letters when they start holding up the Patriot Act, the most obvious question should have been asked in the media and in Congress. Hey, who's targeting these particular guys? This looks kind of fishy. Why would Al-Qaeda want to go after guys who are holding up the Patriot Act? Why would Iraq want to do that? It doesn't make any sense. Yet, for the most part, they don't ask these obvious questions because it's taboo to even imply that your intelligence agency or your executive branch might be complicit in these attacks. It's taboo in the United States, it's taboo in Canada, and it appears to be taboo in general in countries in the West.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show, The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. You have spoken about the physical intimidation of elected representatives as a core feature of the war on terror. You cite the U.S. Congress in September of 2001 and also two different incidents in Canada in 2013 and 2014. I'd like you to talk about these incidents in Canada and their striking resemblance to what went on in September of 2001 in the United States. Let's start with the incident in Canada in 2013. What happened there?
Okay, well, if we want to look at the pattern of what happened here, we have to realize that both the federal police, if you want to call them that, in the U.S. and Canada are both playing a game which is clearly intended to keep the war on terror, which is a fraudulent construction, to keep it going. And one of the ways they do this is by encouraging people, usually marginal, poverty-stricken people, sometimes with drug addiction, sometimes minor prison records, sometimes mentally retarded, any number of things. They target them and draw them into terrorism plots, encourage them, give them money, weapons, self-esteem, ideas, and then they nab them and say, oh, look, we caught a terrorist, and put them away for years and years. So this pattern in the U.S. has been described very well by Trevor Aronson in his book The Terror Factory, Inside the FBI's Manufactured War on Terror. And I really encourage people to get that book, Trevor Aronson. It's a good piece of research because he looked at every court case from 9/11 until I think it was 2013 when he finished his research. Every court case where someone was on trial for terrorism, and read them and came to the conclusion that the FBI was in fact setting these people up again and again and again in order to keep this war on terror going. Well, the thing is that my federal police, the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, are into the same thing. Possibly they're copying the FBI. Maybe they think they're doing it on their own. So the case you're asking me about in 2013 is a classic case of this. We have a couple living together, John Nuttall and Amanda Carodi, and they are poverty-stricken young people living in Vancouver in British Columbia, recovering heroin addicts, trying to get their little lives together and not doing a very good job. And at some point along the way, they seem to self-convert, although this is a bit mysterious, to Islam and decide that they're Muslims. And the guy, John Nuttall, begins talking about the need for jihad and so on. He's a fantasist. There's no indication he is capable, mentally or physically, of carrying out a real act of terrorism, but he likes thinking about it. So he gets, at least according to the narrative I have, reported to the police by the local mosque, which wants to have nothing to do with him. And the police decide, the RCMP decide to set up this elaborate scam, really, which goes on for a long time and involves over 100 RCMP officers. So they do what the FBI normally does. They dress people up as Muslims, and they send them to Nuttall, this guy, and they encourage him, and they buy him a suit, and they tell him he's a good guy, and they start giving him all kinds of ideas, because his terrorism ideals are hilarious. He would never be able to do anything. He wants to fire rockets at Seattle. He wants to, you know, hijack a train, which no longer exists. I mean, they're pure fantasy. And the RCMP knows their fantasy, actually. If you listen to the audio tapes, they know that this guy is just somebody who watched Rambo 3. But they nonetheless, they're determined to entrap this couple. So finally they say to Nuttall, they ball him out to the point where he begins to cry, pretending to be Muslim and saying he has to get serious about his terrorism. So they say, why don't you use a pressure cooker bomb like they did in the Boston Marathon bombing? Don't worry about how to build it. We'll tell you. Don't worry about getting explosives, which he had no access to. We'll get it for you. Pretending all the time to be Muslim friends, of course. And meanwhile, Nuttall is starting to have reservations. He says to them, hey, I'm not a murderer. I need some spiritual guidance. All this stuff is on tape, by the way, because this trial went on and on. And finally, they not only help him construct these pressure cooker bombs, although they give him insufficient explosive to do any damage, they then say, hey, we'll drive you around town to find you a nice place to put them. And they find a nice place behind a bush at the British Columbia Provincial Legislature, okay? And then they arrest them. Well, this comes under the category of intimidation of legislatures. Here is supposedly a bomb which is going to go off right next to the legislature, and also it's going to go off on the national holiday, Canada Day, where there'll be civilians walking around with their kids. And so this this was a classic entrapment case. FBI does it all the time. RCMP has done it a few times. It went to trial. The jury, to my disappointment, found them both guilty of terrorism. But the judge, a woman named Catherine Bruce, had serious reservations. And she decided she was going to look at this more closely because it looked like an entrapment case. And a few months ago, she came out with her decision and she stayed the proceedings. She said, this is no good. It's not acceptable. Let me quote her words. Because she wrote a long report, which is available on the internet. Quote, the world has enough terrorists. We do not need the police to create more out of marginalized people who have neither the capacity nor sufficient motivation to do it themselves. And so on and so forth. Now, the police are, you know, reacting, and they rearrested them, and they're appealing the case and so on. But I think her decision could become very important in helping to draw a line here. But I hope you see how that 2013 case fits what we're talking about here. Here are two Muslim terrorists with great fanfare. They're caught. Their pressure cooker bombs are shown. Pictures of them are shown in the news. Oh, my gosh, they would have blown up civilians and also part of the BC legislature. This is where representatives of the people come in. So this kind of event can not only intimidate the BC legislature, it can intimidate all legislatures across the country in Canada, including Parliament in Ottawa. Everybody will now have to increase their security, make it more difficult for civilians to have access to their elected representatives. So, but you get the idea. That's what happened in 2013. And the only good news here is that at the moment, it's been an embarrassment for our federal police, and it's not clear they're going to come out of this looking good.
Well, I can't help but be struck by the fact that Canada Day, July 1st, 2013, when this incident that you've just been describing took place with these pressure cooker bombs, the so-called Boston bombings took place April 15th of that same year. And the claim is that there were pressure cooker bombs. Now, this is just too big of a coincidence.
Well, it is. It isn't a coincidence. And there are a couple of things worth noting here. First of all, the police agents who were trying to entrap John Nuttall said very clearly, you are not capable of hijacking a train. Okay, let's get real. Here's what you can do. You can, with our help, build a pressure cooker bomb just as they did in the Boston Marathon bombing. So the Canadian federal police are building upon this American case, which also, in my view, looks like another, you know, intelligence operation, by the way, the Boston Marathon bombing. So the intelligence agencies are working together. And by the way, we know they do that. We know the FBI and the RCMP work together often in these cases. That's the first thing to note. The other thing to note is that the Boston Marathon bombings didn't just have a big effect in the U.S. They also had an effect in Canada, and they were used as a pretext to pass legislation in Canada restricting our rights. So again, the effect of these things across borders is very important to think about.
Gee, I didn't know about that legislation in Canada. What is that?
Well, as I recall, this is a bit complicated, but I'll try and sum it up. After the 9/11 attacks, a piece of legislation was passed in Canada in December of 2001, and I don't remember the title of it, but something like anti-terrorism legislation, which clamped down on Canadian rights and gave more power to intelligence agencies and so on. The Liberal government at the time had the good sense to put a sunset clause in to say, in other words, this will lapse automatically unless it is deliberately renewed after a certain period of time by Parliament. Well, that deadline came and Parliament didn't renew it, much to the disappointment of the later Conservative government of Canada, which really wanted that legislation. So, and I believe I'm getting this straight. It's possible I'm getting it wrong, but I think I'm getting it right. The Conservative government finally got its opportunity a few years later to renew that legislation after the Boston Marathon bombings. That gave them the opportunity. The public was scared. Parliament was scared. And that was the opportunity they seized. Now, after the October 22nd, 2014 terrorism incident, which we haven't talked about yet, another even worse piece of legislation was passed restricting Canadians' civil rights, but that's a different story.
Well, Graham, would you like to give us a synopsis of the October 2014 incident? Now, this took place at the Parliament of Canada in Ottawa. What happened there?
Right. Well, October 22nd, 2014, perhaps I should say that week in Canada was quite remarkable historically because there were two, quote, unquote, terrorism events that happened in rapid succession. On what I believe was a Monday, October 20th, an apparently Muslim guy with the big beard and the outfit and so on got in his car and ran down two Canadian soldiers. One was injured and one died. Okay, that was on October 20th. 2 days later, October 22nd, another terrorism incident happens where another apparent Muslim by the name of Michael Zihaf Bibo. You can put all that in quotes because our knowledge of the event is almost entirely from the federal police, whom we obviously can't trust. But for the moment, let's assume it's true. Michael Zihaf Bibo, Muslim, first of all, gets out of his car with a rifle and shoots at two Canadian soldiers who are on duty, ceremonial duty, with empty rifles at the National War Memorial in Ottawa, which is just a short walk from Parliament. He takes out his rifle. He shoots one of the men, Corporal Cirillo, who then dies. He tries to shoot a second guy, but the guy evades the shots, manages to get away unharmed. Then he runs, he gets in his car with his rifle. He drives as far as he can toward Parliament, and then there's bollards there where he can't drive any farther. So he gets out of the car, and he runs onto the grounds of Parliament with this rifle and a little bandana over his face and his long hair and beard flowing. He hijacks a ministerial car, which is not far from Parliament. In other words, he tells the driver to get out or he'll shoot him. He gets in the car with his rifle. It's hard to say all this without laughing. He drives that car right past two federal police cars, two RCMP cars, which are stationed there, neither of which does anything to impede him. They then follow him in their cars as he drives directly to the entrance to the main Parliament building called Center Block, where the Canadian Parliament meets. He then gets out of that car, runs into the building with a loaded rifle, and runs down the central hall called the Hall of Honor. Now, on one side of it is the Prime Minister of Canada with his Conservative caucus around him. They formed the government at the time. This is behind an unlocked door. On the other side of the Hall of Honor is the official opposition, the NDP, having their meeting, also unlocked door. So this is considered, for obvious reasons, the greatest security breach in the history of Parliament. Here's this guy with a loaded rifle running down the hall. He could have, in theory, killed a bunch of parliamentarians. Well, the fact that he even got that far is astonishing. Managed to get in the front door, managed to get past the guards. Eventually, they pull out their pistols, the guards, and begin firing at him. And within 2 minutes, he's dead. And there's a whole other story that I could talk about there. Perhaps if we have time to go threat, unity, and response, we can go through those stages, but that's the summary of the incident. He does not, in fact, kill anybody. He does not shoot anybody in Parliament. There's one guard that's slightly wounded by a ricochet, but he doesn't shoot anybody. He himself is brought down quite quickly. That, in a nutshell, is the incident.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show, The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter. And what was the reaction by the authorities to this incident?
Well, of course, just as U.S. Congress was thoroughly intimidated on 9/11 and fled in all directions, here we have members of Parliament stuck behind closed doors, which aren't locked, hearing a huge amount of gunfire happening right outside the doors. I mean, as far as we can tell, 59 shots are fired very rapidly. They don't know who's there. It could be a team of guys with assault rifles. So they're scared, naturally. They're thoroughly intimidated. And that's in my little threefold pattern here, threat, unity, response. That's threat. And they were certainly scared. They did not hesitate to say so. They were also then grateful to the security services who saved them. And in the end, the terrorist, in quotes, the Hafbibo, was killed by two guys, one of whom was the head of security for Parliament, for that building, a man by the name of Kevin Vickers. Now, Vickers happened to be not only the head of security, but also a symbolic figure who, in a fancy uniform, he carries the mace into Parliament. And if he doesn't do that, Parliament can't meet. So he's a crucial guy, and he's familiar. So then we have this brilliant piece of video footage from the day after this event, in which he brings the mace into Parliament. We're talking about a symbolic object that he carries, which looks like a huge cudgel. It comes from British parliamentary traditions, a very old tradition. So he carries this big kind of gold-plated thing, and he's all dressed up in robes, and that's what he carries into Parliament. Well, just imagine how grateful members of Parliament are. This is the guy who saved them. This is the guy who killed the terrorist. So they all rise to their feet and begin to clap. It doesn't matter what party you're in, NDP, Conservative, Green, whatever, you clap. And that's another powerful symbol of unity. It's like Congress singing God Bless America. It's a very similar image. So again, we have unity. And then we have, just as Daschle and Bush hugged, we have famous hugs, which I managed to find photos of the Prime Minister of Canada, Mr. Harper, a very unhuggy man, by the way. He looks so awkward hugging them, but he does it. He hugs the official leader of the opposition. He hugs Mr. Trudeau, the head of the Liberal Party, who's now the Prime Minister. And we have Mr. Harper, the Prime Minister, giving a little speech about unity and we will not be intimidated and so on. And from that unity, we move over to response. And guess what? Both elements are there again. Domestically, a new bill is introduced, C-51, which infringes on traditional Canadian civil rights and gives more power to intelligence agencies in Canada. And externally, guess what? There's legitimation of a very recent Canadian military presence in Iraq. And they immediately name one of their army bases in Iraq after the soldier killed on October 22nd. And very clear sign that this legitimizes our military mission. So, again, we have threat, unity, and response, and in some ways very similar to the pattern set down in the U.S.
Now, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, who were implicated in the 2013 event as having entrapped these people, they were also in charge at Parliament in Ottawa during the 2014 event.
That's right. They had responsibility for the security of the area of what is called Parliament Hill, not inside the building, but the hill itself. But in fact, what we discovered is that they were way short of personnel. And they had, in fact, terminated some patrols that they'd been taking just a couple of days before this event. And it's peculiar because the head of the RCMP said, oh, we were completely caught off guard by this event. But that's false. I mean, he just lied. There were at least six warnings, and these warnings were quite specific. And, you know, they're all documented. And when I say they're specific, I mean, for example, a man who works for the British Columbia legislature said quite promptly, oh, we got a warning that something might happen this week, meaning a terrorist event. Well, guess what? Something did happen this week. Two terrorist events happened that week. That's pretty specific. So as one journalist said, who had a little bit of brains here, he said, if the BC legislature was prepared, why wasn't the national legislature? Why wasn't Parliament prepared? Why wasn't the RCMP prepared? And there are many, many serious questions about how this was handled. And I think if the RCMP were forced into a corner, they would say, oh, well, you know, we didn't have enough funding, and so we didn't respond as quickly as we should have. But of course, there is a much darker option here, and that is that they may have been complicit in this event, just as they set up this impoverished, bearded young drug addict in Vancouver the previous year. They may also have entrapped another bearded, impoverished drug addict from Vancouver, namely Siaf Bibo, a year later. And that's what I'm worried about. I'm worried about direct complicity by the RCMP and possibly the FBI in entrapping this guy to do the event. And that's the taboo possibility. That's the one you're not allowed to mention in public. That's the one the journalists don't talk about. Parliamentarians don't talk about it. It's okay to say the RCMP may have been incompetent. You know, it's okay to say that Ziad Bibo may not have been a terrorist. He might have just been mentally ill. You know, that's the kind of liberal position. But it's not okay to say our federal police may have been complicit in this, just as they were complicit the year before in entrapping somebody.
And isn't it also true that the RCMP reported that these so-called terrorists in Canadian Parliament in Ottawa had fired 30 shots, and it turned out he only fired two?
Well, that's slightly oversimplified, but you're pretty much on target. In other words, there was an attempt to exaggerate, an attempt, I wouldn't say so much on the part of the RCMP as by some Canadian members of the government who tried to exaggerate the degree of threat that this man represented, that he could have killed all these people. It was as if he'd had a sophisticated assault rifle, which was, you know, recently loaded. This was not true at all. He carried a Model 94 Winchester 3030, a deer rifle, and it was designed in 1894. That's his rifle. It appears to have had two bullets in it, three at maximum, when he ran into the Parliament. And of the 59 bullets that parliamentarians heard, the 59 shots, 56 were fired by the police with 9mm pistols, and the man was hit 31 times. He was finally killed at point-blank range, between 3 and, say, 10 feet, by two guys who fired repeatedly into him, including once he had fallen to the ground, meaning there will be no trial. He's dead. And there has been no call for a public inquiry either. So at the moment, we are completely trapped within the police narrative of what happened.
Do you consider the war on terror in general to be a threat to democracy?
Oh, certainly. It's a threat to democracy in all sorts of ways. But what I've been trying to stress recently in a couple of talks is this threat to representative democracy specifically. So where the executive and the associated intelligence agencies physically intimidates Parliament or Congress, the elected representatives of the people, and gets them to pass various laws which they otherwise wouldn't do. And it's sometimes hard to get people worked up about this because people are often quite cynical already about their parliaments and their Congress. You know, when I talk to most Americans that I know, they kind of go ho-hum when you say Congress was intimidated because they say Congress doesn't represent us anyway. Well, if that's the case, that's a problem. But I still think if our representative democracies are being disassembled in front of our eyes, we ought to take note of that. And it may be one of these cases where you don't know what you've got till it's gone. After all, Congress was not exactly on fire with the spirit of resistance during the Vietnam War, but they did, in the end, deny the executive the funds necessary to continue that war, and that's why that war ended. And we're not seeing anything, even at that kind of low level of feistiness at the moment. So I would say, defective though it may be, the representative democracy we have is better than a straight authoritarian state, which is where I'm afraid we're headed.
With regard to the war on terror, do you see it as the executive branch obviously intimidating not only the legislative branch of government, but also the judicial?
I think that's true. And I think there's also danger, I realize, of oversimplification. You know, what do I mean by the executive branch? I mean, for example, in the case of the Kennedy assassination, it was the head of the executive branch, the president, who was killed. There's no automatic immunity for presidents and vice presidents and so on. But I think what we're seeing in the war on terror specifically, on these frauds rather than the frauds of the 60s, is that in general the executive branch, and by the way, executive branch doesn't just mean the president, okay, in the United States. It includes the intelligence agencies. It is usually used that term in a way to include the FBI and the CIA and a variety of others as well, the NSA, the DIA. And so these are all considered part of the executive branch, as is the Pentagon. So that's what I'm talking about. That's a hugely powerful set of agencies. And here's poor Congress, the lawmakers elected by the people, up against that mammoth set of institutions and being repeatedly intimidated in all kinds of ways. That's the particular threat. That's the particular danger that I'm highlighting at the moment. And I think that's what we're seeing in the war on terror.
Graham McQueen, thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome, Bonnie. It's always a delight to be on your show.
There's something happening, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
I've been speaking with Dr. Graham McQueen. Today's show has been The War on Terror, Targeting Elected Officials. Since taking early retirement from McMaster University, most of Dr. McQueen's research has focused on the events of September 11th and the War on Terror. He is a co-editor of the Journal of 9/11 Studies, a member of the 9/11 Consensus Panel, and was on the organizing committee of the 2011 Toronto hearings on 9/11. He currently serves on the board of directors of the International Center for 9/11 Studies, which has secured the release of numerous photographs and videos held by the U.S. government. Recently, he has completed a report entitled The October 22nd, 2014 Ottawa Shootings, Why Canadians Need a Public Inquiry. He is the author of the 2001 Anthrax Deception, The Case for a Domestic Conspiracy, available at claritypress.com. That's claritypress.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yara Mako, and Tony Rango. Visit us at gunsandbutter.org to listen to past programs, comment on shows, or join our email list to receive our newsletter, which includes recent shows and updates. Email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. Follow us on Twitter at GNB Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
New World Notes.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Tariq Ali on the future of Palestine. I hope you'll stay tuned. Tariq Ali is a left-leaning scholar and writer now living in London. He's the editor of New Left Review, and he's the author of more than a dozen books. He is a fine and articulate critic of the U.S. and British foreign policies. Tariq Ali was born in 1943 in Lahore, Pakistan. His parents had converted from Islam to atheism and communism, and Tariq has followed somewhat similar paths. In May 2016, he spoke at the Left Forum in New York. He was on a panel along with the American scholar and critic of Zionism, Norman Finkelstein. Ali and Finkelstein discussed the sad situation of the people of Palestine. They have suffered under a brutal and illegal blockade and military occupation by Israel, the occupation now nearly 50 years long. Today, we'll hear Tariq Ali's remarks exclusively, and we'll hear from Finkelstein in the near future. In his talk, Ali says remarkably little about Israel. In fact, he begins by condemning the people of the Palestinian Authority, the corrupt puppet government in Palestine established by and funded by the Israeli occupiers and by the United States. Ali moves on to the worldwide BDS campaign, the campaign to pressure Israel to end its oppression of Palestine through boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel and Israeli products. Ali sees BDS as a good idea, but not sufficient to save Palestine. The Palestinian people need to form an organized mass movement too, as the South Africans did. And the Palestinian people will have to do it independently of Palestine's corrupt so-called leaders. Ali also touches on why the two-state solution is no longer a viable option for Palestine, and on how occupied Palestine is different from the old apartheid South Africa, and on why the Bernie Sanders movement is so encouraging. It's a wide-ranging intellectual tour de force and well worth a listen, maybe several listens. On the past and future of Palestine, here is Tariq Ali.
I think if we are brutally honest, we have to say that the Palestinian organizations, especially the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which negotiated the Oslo Accords, has participated and collaborated in the defeat that has been inflicted on the Palestinian people.
They want you to hold the mic a little higher.
I think this collaboration was absolutely vital for the Israelis in order to do what they are now doing. And I think the debate and discussion that has now opened up, even within the PLO, is an indication that everyone now knows, there's no secret, not that they didn't know it before, that this is the way they were going. And for a long time it was difficult to say it. I mean, I've been saying it for 10, 15 years in different parts of the world, including at conferences organized by Palestinians themselves. And in private, a lot of them would agree, you're right, but we can't say it in public. I said, you have to say it in public. It shouldn't be left to people like me to say it. You have to say it. because saying it will be helpful and will not allow the people to get too demoralized. If no one opens their mouths from within the leadership or lower echelons or lower ranking cadres of that organization, we are sunk. And in fact, as we know, the scale of the collaboration was huge. Of the money given to the Palestinian, so-called Palestinian Authority, which was Palestinian but which had no authority at all, because never was there a Palestinian Authority. From the beginning, the real authority was the IDF, and behind it the Israeli government, and behind it the White House and the State Department, i.e. the United States of America. So there was never any Palestinian Authority. What they had was a budget. Billions came in. A majority segment of this budget was spent on what? Security. Security, let's see what is meant by security. Defending the Palestinian people against the onslaughts of the IDF? No, perish the thought. The security they talked about was to keep their own people under control and to deal with rival factions of Palestinians in Gaza, etc. That's what the bulk of the money was spent on. Where did some of the rest of the money go? It went in enriching those who were organizing this so-called Palestinian Authority. Political leaders, including right at the very top, low-level cadres, they were bought off and told, we've struggled enough, let's enjoy life for a bit. But, you know, we're all in favor of enjoying life for a bit if your own people aren't living in such dire and desperate conditions. And this is what was completely ignored. And, you know, I have a very dear friend, a Palestinian poet who lives in Cairo, who told me when I went to Ramallah, a close friend of mine, we had fought together in the old days, took me up the mountain and showed me his brand new villa, which must have cost God knows, you know, $500,000 or the equivalent thereof. And he said, look, this is how I live now, and I'm happy. And he said, I felt like slapping his face, because not so far away were people who were living in really appalling conditions. And this money, which could have been used to aid every Palestinian family, to build schools, to build small clinics, etc., etc., was frittered away. And the Israelis knew what they were doing. They were buying off the top layers of Palestinian society within the PLO. And we have now reached a situation where I was at a conference in Spain, in Cordoba, a few weeks ago, sharing a platform with the Palestinian Minister for Finance and Economics. And everything I've said to you, I said to his face. And he admitted, he said, yeah, perhaps we spent too much on security. And I said, what about the $2 billion bribe scandal? And he said, that's exaggerated. No open denial. It's a huge tragedy that the leaders of a movement could be bought off and bought off so easily. So he then turned to me and said, well, what would you do? I said, for one thing, what I would do now really, because enough is enough, is say to the world at large, there is no authority, there is no Palestinian authority. We are going to dump it. It doesn't exist. We are just Palestinians in this region which is occupied by Israel. And dear world and dear people in the world, that's what we are. Are you going to help us? Please do. If not, we'll struggle on and live together and share each other's goods and money as long as we can, because that is what is needed. And he said, well, there's a logic in what you say. But I said, the logic, if it exists for you, has come too bloody late for the Palestinian people. They know what you've done. The Israelis do horrific things, as Norman has eloquently described and has been describing for years. But I said being defeated by your own leadership is psychologically and politically very damning. That is much more difficult to get over, because you then say, what alternative do we have? Where are we going? So I say that as long as this is recognized, and they are beginning to recognize it, it's difficult not to, that they have lost the battle for a Palestinian state. That Palestinian state, which they dreamed of, even on the 67 frontiers, is not going to happen, because the occupation settlements have just encroached too far into Palestinian territory. There is no Israeli government which is going to remove them, because it won't have the support of its own population to do so. The United States is indifferent, always has been indifferent to the fate of the Palestinians, and more so after the 67 war. So there's going to be no help from the so-called international community, by which is just a code word for referring to the United States. There's no such thing as an international community. So in this situation, far better that the Palestinians acknowledge of their situation and then see how to proceed forward. The situation is grim. It's pointless prettifying it or finding hope in tiny things. Not that these tiny things are not important. The BDS campaign is important. It's important not because it'll bring down the Israeli government. That is an illusion, that it will bring down the Israeli government. The South African government was not brought down by sanctions. It was brought down by the defeat inflicted by the Cuban army on South Africa. But sanctions on their own are never decisive. I nonetheless support them. Why? Because it is an important way to project what is going on in the world of Israel and Palestine and in the world at large, and on that front it's been effective. The reason the Israeli government is so hostile to it is not that they feel threatened by the sanctions, but because it disgraces them. It shames them. They have to answer questions about it. When campuses in the United States or parts of Europe stand up and say, we demand a boycott of Israel, it shames even the American government, which finds this horrifying, and European governments, which have done absolutely nothing to aid the Palestinians. So these movements, societal movements from below, are extremely important from that particular vantage point, and that's why I was a signatory to it, from the beginning, without any illusions, but understanding its importance. And this is why now there's a huge campaign. They've outlawed BDS in France, which, by the way, is the most pro-Israeli country in Europe today. And the appointment of Mark Negev, a friend of Netanyahu's and formerly Netanyahu's press officer, who you probably saw complacent and unctuous on television screens defending the indefensible, is now the ambassador in London to see if he can persuade the Conservative government to do what the French have done and make BDS activities illegal. And allied to this comes a new campaign, which is not new, of course, in the United States, but is new in large parts of Europe, whereby the chief rabbi in Britain said there is no such thing as anti-Zionism that is not also anti-Semitism. Actually said this, and said that anti-Zionism, people who talk about anti-Zionism, are anti-Semitic. Of course, liberal Jews and the Jewish Voices for Peace, thankfully there are many more of these still in British society than the other, came out very strongly denouncing this. So there is a debate going on, And you ask yourself, why is it that suddenly this campaign of anti-Semitism got sparked off in Britain? That's because the Labour Party, to its own horror and shock, has the membership has elected a leader who is very well known for being a defender of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian movement. And it is this that has panicked them, so they're denouncing people in his circles, etc. Sometimes Ken Livingstone, the former mayor of London, says something which is three-quarters accurate but not 100% and says it in a temper without rationally arguing it, so they pounce on him. Or another member of parliament who 2 years ago forwarded one of Norm's texts and satirical blogs, satire is fatal these days, satirical blogs saying that all the Israeli Jews could, of course, come back and live in the United States if they want to, since many of them went from Brooklyn and so whatever. So this is so obviously a satirical blog, and she found it amusing and forwarded it. She's been accused of anti-Semitism because she was foolish. Instead of saying this is a blog by Norman Finkelstein, I forwarded, then they could deal with Norman directly. But instead, she panicked and apologized and went on her knees. They've still suspended her from the Labour Party. Because the worst thing to do in these situations is not to fight back. If you don't fight back, they carry on and on and on. So this is what's going on. And you know, the irony of the situation is that if you want to know the community in Europe which is really suffering, it is the Muslim communities. There is a huge wave of Islamophobia in many parts of Europe, I would say virtually all of Europe, which in its manifestations is not that different from the attacks that were made on Jewish people in the 20s and 30s and even in the 40s and even in the 50s after the Second World War. A lot of the arguments being used against Muslims are very similar. Someone has actually done an analysis of what was written about the Jews and what is being written about the Muslims. Almost exactly the same. And yet, does anyone care? No, well, we do. But by and large, this is completely ignored because the media is a part of it. So that is the situation that we confront. And of course, you know, we fight it back. But the Palestinians have to understand, and I think increasingly they do, that the state they visualized is impossible. So the only hope, I can't see any other way out, is a solution which many staunch Israeli anti-Zionists from the Matzpen group and others have defended for a long time. And many of them educated me in this whole idea about 40 years ago, that the only viable long-term solution is a single Israeli-Palestinian state with equal rights for Jews, Muslims, Christians, Palestinians, Druids, whatever. I won't get involved in an argument with Norm on Gandhi at this particular forum. I must say my views on Gandhi coming from that subcontinent are very different from the idealized picture which has been developed of him, not just by Norm, but by Western society as a whole. Interestingly enough, I can't resist telling you this, that in 1938, the Nobel Peace Prize Committee had a shortlist of people in front of it, and they couldn't decide whether to give the Nobel Peace Prize to Mahatma Gandhi, who, whatever my disagreements, certainly deserved it. They couldn't decide whether to give it to Mahatma Gandhi or Adolf Hitler. We which shows how deep Western dilemmas go. But anyway, I agree on Gaza, of course. I would just say to Norman that what he's described, of course, another political theorist of a current, he now doesn't like the Bolsheviks, also once asserted that the chain breaks at its weakest link. And quoting Lenin's words, one can also reach the same conclusion that the weakest link in the chain of oppression in Israel-Palestine today is without doubt Gaza. And one should concentrate efforts, all possible efforts, to try and break the blockade. I'm completely in favor of that, have supported all the ships that have gone and all the different campaigns that have been involved. But that would be a huge leap forward and would possibly revitalize the mass movement in the rest of the region, because it's true, I took it for granted that the Cubans inflicting a military defeat on this vaunted, you know, white South African army was a huge blow to them. And Nelson Mandela, the first country he visited after he was released was Cuba. He said we owed them a blood debt, because without that defeat we might have been stuck for some time to come. But it goes without granted, there's a huge mass movement in South Africa, which varied, it was crushed, it rose again. You had new mass movements in Soweto and the townships. You then had armed struggle, strikes, guerrilla actions, which weren't so successful, by the way, even in South Africa. And then the Cuban triumph, and then we know the history. But the point I was going to make was that even with the blockade on Gaza being lifted, which would create the basis for a new, different type of mass movement of the Palestinians and their few allies in that region, we still have to have some overall plan which will not be fulfilled today or tomorrow or the day after. And that is where the question of what are your aims comes in, because if you have no plan, if the two-state solution is ended, you have to think, however unrealistic it might appear, at least pose the question of something else. And I think large parts of the world understand this now. Instinctively, it's true that in Europe, public opinion now, I mean, there have been a number of polls when they've actually asked, which do you think is the most dangerous state in the world? A fairly large proportion of Europeans, especially the young, reply, Israel. Why? Because they know Israel is a nuclear state. They know it's carrying out quite a brutal occupation. They know that the United States backs it. They fear because that there could be an accidental nuclear war. Who knows what as a war of last resort? So there is this growing feeling, which, of course, the elitist politicians in Europe don't represent and don't reflect. But some big shift and some big movement within the region itself could spark off real mass struggles or movements to put huge pressure on the governments of Europe and, I hope, North America. I mean, the thing about Bernie Sanders' campaign, which I should say, is that in all my memory of American politics, my own memories and experience, I have not seen a campaign like this. Someone will correct me if I'm wrong. That a campaign to become the candidate of a mainstream party virtually launches a huge popular movement and a popular political movement, not a single issue movement, in this country. Now, I know at the Left Forum there are many critics of Bernie, and fine, that's normal. But it's not even a question of his person, actually, in some ways. Why couldn't anyone else have triggered such a movement off? Precisely because of he's different from the others. People feel that. It was the same with Jeremy Corbyn in Britain. And when people were asked, but how can you like him? Pollsters said, but why do you like him? The reply came, because he's different from the politicians. And the politicians are quite a hated subgrouping now, globally, but especially in Europe. And the fact that I think Sanders is the first serious senior politician of a political party who did not go to AIPAC, that does mark a small breakthrough, and we should be grateful.
Yeah.
Because that breaks... It breaks the hold this organization has over the political structure. I mean, no other country, this is an imperial power, the most powerful country in the world, and after 9/11, both the Senate and the House voted a blank check to Israel. Whatever you do, we will support you. Whatever you do, you can wipe out the entire Palestinian nation, and we will support you. Unheard of. Unheard of. So, as time proceeds and as the decades pass by, it would be great to mark the 50th anniversary of the occupation, being able to celebrate something, and the lifting of the siege of Gaza, the sanctions on Gaza, the victimization of Gaza would be a huge step forward. So on that I'm in total agreement. It's not enough, of course, but it could be the pattern and the launch pad for something much, much bigger in the region. Because what is clear is that there's going to be no help from any other Arab state. Not that there was too much even before this, but at least during the days of Nasser and Arab nationalism, they tried, they gave them refuge, they trained them, they gave them weapons, they helped. That's all gone now, with the Saudi Arabians effectively on the same line as the Israeli government. Think about that. The most hardened faction within Islam, the Wahhabis, literalists, Islamic literalists, effectively on exactly the same line as Israel because of factional disputes against their rivals within Islam and because they are now fearful that something might happen inside their own country. So it's a very strange situation which releases the Palestinian movement in many ways from the Saudis and from these other countries, which helps a mass movement if it's politically and psychologically independent of some extremely unpleasant regimes in that region.
Tariq Ali, speaking on the future of Palestine here on New World Notes. Thanks to David Schoenfeld, my colleague at WWUH in West Hartford, for making available the complete audio recording, which I have edited and condensed for radio broadcast. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, inviting you to check out our website, newworldnotes.blogspot.com, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao.
listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politics. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. No short head.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. James Corbett of the Corbett Report has recently put together some videos on a few 9/11 suspects. Today I'm going to share two of these with you. The first one is about 9/11 suspect and former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani. And the second one is about 9/11 suspect Philip Zelikow, who wrote the outline for the 9/11 Commission report before the commissioners had even met. So let's begin first with 9/11 suspect Rudy Giuliani. And here's James Corbett of the Corbett Report.
After stepping down as mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani tried to launch himself as a national political leader on the back of the single defining event of his career.
September 11th, September 11th. Terrorists or terrorism, September 11th. The flames of hell emanating from those buildings. September 11th, fallen towers of the World Trade Center. Terrorists, September 11th, 2001.
In the end, he failed miserably, with voters immediately seeing his ploy for what it was. Base political pandering.
9/11 was bad.
I agree with that.
God, I can't believe how easy this is.
But what many do not realize is that Giuliani's case is not just that of another ghoulish politician parading on the corpses of those who died on his watch for his own political gain. On the day of 9/11, while the remains of the Twin Towers and World Trade Center 7 were still smoldering, one of Mayor Giuliani's first concerns was clearing away the evidence from the crime scene.
We were able to move 120 dump trucks out of the city last night, which will give you a sense of the work that was done overnight.
It's wild out here. They just keep coming. Look. It doesn't stop. There's more. I keep thinking it's at the end, and it's not.
Despite reassurances that the rapid removal of the evidence from Ground Zero was important for emergency access, this process went far beyond merely clearing a path for rescue workers. As Eric Lawyer, founder of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, points out, the massive operation to haul away over 1.5 million tons of debris and to sell much of the steel to Chinese firm Baosteel at discount prices was not just an overzealous approach to clearing the area, but was itself a crime.
9/11 was the greatest loss of life and property damage in U.S. fire history. This should have been the most protected, preserved, overtested, and thorough investigation of a crime scene in world history. Sadly, it was not. What was it? Well, we know from their own admission, the majority of the evidence was destroyed. I, like Richard said, 22 years of experience, I've seen a lot of crime scenes, I've never seen anything like this in my life. I was out at the site, I saw trucks leaving faster than, you know, anywhere I've ever seen, but I accepted it at the time, and for years I accepted it because it was a recovery and rescue operation, and that's normal to have something like that going. Again, we never seen anything like it, but that was expected. What I didn't know for years, what was going on behind the scenes, was that evidence was being destroyed when it was shipped off. By their own admission, Tower 7 investigation, this investigation of Tower 7 had no physical evidence. How do you investigate a crime when you've destroyed all the evidence? It doesn't make sense. They also admit that they refused to test the explosives or to test for explosives or residue of thermite. Now, this is what I'm going to go into here just real quickly, is there are national standards for an investigation. That's what all of us are asking for, an investigation that follows national standards and holds people accountable.
Needless to say, an investigation of the 9/11 crime scene following the national investigation standards has never been conducted and never will be, as Giuliani oversaw the illegal destruction of the evidence itself. To add insult to this injury, in 2003, New York City medical examiner Charles Hirsch revealed that in the mad scramble to get rid of the crime scene evidence, human remains from the World Trade Center had been left at the Freshkills landfill, where the debris was sorted and the steel was sold. In 2007, Eric Beck, a senior supervisor of the recycling facility that sifted the debris, admitted that some of those human remains ended up in a mixture that was used to pave roads and fill potholes in New York City. But as grotesque as such revelations are, they are not the most shocking part of Giuliani's 9/11 story. In the late 1990s, the mayor oversaw the creation of a state-of-the-art $13 million emergency command center to coordinate the city's disaster recovery and response efforts. Located on the 23rd floor of World Trade Center Building 7, just across Vesey Street from the Twin Towers, the center, dubbed by local press at the time as Giuliani's Bunker, included reinforced, bulletproof, and bomb-resistant walls, its own air supply and water tank, beds, showers to accommodate 30 people, and three backup generators. It could be used to monitor all of New York's emergency communications frequencies and was staffed 24 hours a day. And yet, remarkably, on the morning of 9/11, neither Mayor Giuliani nor any other city personnel or police or fire department officials were in the bunker after the Twin Tower strikes.
As I told you guys before, it was very funny. I was on my way to work, and traffic was excellent. I received a call that a small Cessna had hit the World Trade Center, and I was asked to go and man the Office of Emergency Management. Upon arriving into the OEM EOC, we noticed that everybody was gone. I saw coffee that was on a desk. Still, the smoke was still coming off the coffee. I saw half-eaten sandwiches.
And as a sidebar comment, you just heard the late Barry Jennings speaking. He died mysteriously in 2008, right before NIST released their report on the collapse of World Trade Center 7. And now back to James Corbett.
So why wasn't the mayor and the city's emergency personnel in the location that had been purpose-built for just such an event? According to Giuliani, they had been told to evacuate because they had been given a warning that the Twin Towers were going to collapse. A warning that was evidently not passed on to any of the emergency personnel that were still working in the buildings.
I went down to the scene and we set up headquarters at 75 Barclay Street, which was right there with the police commissioner, the fire commissioner, the head of emergency management. And we were operating out of there when we were told that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. And it did collapse before we could actually get out of the building. So we were trapped in the building for 10, 15 minutes and finally found an exit and got out, walked north, and took a lot of people with us.
Giuliani, in his own words, has admitted that he was warned that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. This despite the fact that there was no possible way for this to be predicted in the first hour of the unfolding disaster. Even more incredibly, despite being given this warning, no effort was made to pass it on to the police, firefighters, and other responders who were still working in and around the buildings. When precisely was this warning given? And by whom? Why, despite acting on this warning himself, did Giuliani make no effort to pass the warning on to others? Predictably, when confronted with these questions by activists during his 2008 presidential campaign, Giuliani merely smiled and denied that he had ever received such a warning.
You reported to Peter Jennings that on 9/11 that World Trade Towers were going to collapse, and no steel structure in history has ever collapsed due to a fire. How come the people in the buildings weren't notified, and who else knew right about this, and how do you sleep at night?
Ma'am, I didn't know that the towers were going to collapse.
He reported it to
also,
Peter Jennings.
No.
You said on Peter Jennings on ABC
and
video,
also,
you indeed said that the towers, you were notified the towers were going to collapse while you were in some, not sure exactly where you were prior to, but you said on ABC video with Peter Jennings in an interview that you were aware that towers were going to collapse in advance. We'd like to know who told you the towers were going to collapse in advance, sir, and also we'd like to know who else you told.
Well, the fact is that I didn't realize the towers would collapse. I never realized that.
So where was the mayor on 9/11? On Pier 92, which was already set up as a functional command center due to a full-scale emergency drill by FEMA that, by a remarkable coincidence, had been scheduled for the following day.
And we selected Pier 92 as our command center. And the reason Pier 92 was selected as the command center was because on the next day, on September 12th, Pier 92 was going to have a drill. It had hundreds of people here, from FEMA, from the federal government, from the state emergency management office, and they were getting ready for a drill for biochemical attack. So that was going to be the place they were going to have the drill. The equipment was already there. So we were able to establish a command center there within 3 days that was 2.5 to 3 times bigger than the command center that we had lost at 7 World Trade Center. And it was from there that the rest of the search and rescue effort was completed.
Mayor Giuliani oversaw the illegal destruction of the 9/11 crime scene and is criminally liable for the deaths of hundreds of emergency workers for not passing on prior warnings about the collapses of the Twin Towers. It is no wonder, then, that the Fire Department of New York so passionately detests Giuliani for his actions in disgracing their fallen brothers and covering up the 9/11 crime.
Rudy Giuliani has used the horrible events of September 11, 2001, to create a carefully crafted persona. But the fact is, what Rudy portrays is not a full picture of the decisions made that led, in our view, to the unnecessary deaths of our FDNY members and the attempt to stop the dignified recovery of those lost. The urban legend of America's mayor needs to be balanced by the truth.
So what is the reward for Giuliani's criminal actions on 9/11? An offer to become the head of the Department of Homeland Security in the event of a Trump presidency, of course. This is the state of American politics, and this is precisely why a true investigation of what happened on 9/11 never has, and never will, be conducted by the U.S. government itself.
And now you'll hear James Corbett talk about 9/11 suspect Philip Zelikow.
It took President Bush an extraordinary 441 days after 9/11 to establish a commission to investigate the events of September 11, 2001. And it was not just the case that Bush was slow in acting. He actively resisted any investigation for as long as he could, taking the extraordinary and unprecedented step of personally asking Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to limit Congress's investigation into those events. In the end, the commission was severely underfunded, severely rushed, and, as commission chairman Thomas Kane later admitted,
"We think the commission in many ways was set up to fail."
But the most unmistakable sign that Bush was only interested in appointing a cover-up commission to investigate the largest attack on U.S. soil in modern history was his initial choice for commission chairman.
"Today I'm pleased to announce my choice for commission chairman, Dr. Henry Kissinger."
"Dr. Kissinger, do you have any concerns about, once the commission begins its work, if fingers point to valuable allies, say Saudi Arabia, for example, the implications, the policy implications this could have to the United States, particularly at this delicate time?"
I have been given every assurance by the president that we should go where the facts lead us."
Not even the New York Times could believe that Henry Kissinger, the consummate Washington insider, could pretend to conduct an independent fact-finding investigation into 9/11. It is tempting to wonder if the choice of Mr. Kissinger is not a clever maneuver by the White House to contain an investigation it long opposed, the Times editorialized after the announcement. Kissinger may have been prepared for such polite disagreement with his appointment, but he was not prepared to meet the 9/11 widows whose tireless efforts had forced the creation of the commission in the first place.
"Several family members approached Kissinger and requested a meeting at his office in New York. Prior to the meeting, Kristen Breitweiser conducted a thorough investigation of Kissinger's potential conflicts of interest."
"Probably much to the chagrin of some of the people in the room, Lori asked some very pointed questions. Would you have any Saudi American clients that you would like to tell us about?" and he was very uncomfortable, kind of twisting and turning on the couch. And then she asked whether he had any clients by the name of Bin Laden. And he just about fell off his couch.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger stepped down from the position Friday.
We thought the meeting went well.
Kissinger was dethroned, and the commission went ahead under Chairman Thomas Kane and Vice Chair Lee Hamilton. But while Kissinger's appointment and resignation received all the attention, the White House was busy slipping another agent into the commission through the back door. In January of 2003, just weeks after Kissinger stepped down, it was quietly announced that Philip D. Zelikow would take on the role of executive director. As executive director, Zelikow picked the areas of investigation, the briefing materials, the topics for hearings, the witnesses, and the lines of questioning for witnesses. In effect, this was the man in charge of running the investigation itself. So who was Philip Zelikow? The commission's press release announcing his position described him as a man of high stature who has distinguished himself as an academician, lawyer, author, and public servant. Although they noted his position at the University of Virginia and his previous role as executive director for the National Commission on Federal Electoral Reform, curiously missing from this brief bio are the multiple conflicts of interest that show how the Bush administration essentially put one of its own in charge of investigating how the Bush administration failed on 9/11. In 1995, Zelikow co-authored a book with Bush's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice. He was part of the transition team that helped the Bush administration take over the White House from the Clinton administration. He was even a member of Bush's post-9/11 Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. But perhaps most incredibly, Zelikow actually authored the Bush administration's 2002 national security strategy that outlined the preemptive war doctrine that would be used against Iraq. This, however, is something that not even 9/11 commissioners Kane or Hamilton themselves knew at the time the commission was formed.
Zelikow was the author of a very important document issued by the White House in September 2002 that really turned military doctrine on its head and said that the United States could become involved in preemptive war, preemptive defense, that we could attack a nation that didn't pose an immediate military threat to this country. And obviously in September 2002, it sure appeared that that document was being written with one target in mind, Iraq. Now, as I say, the author of the document at the time was anonymous. We didn't know that Philip Zelikow had written this thing, and that becomes known, I think, widely on the staff only in the final months of the 9/11 Commission investigation, and it appeared to pose yet another conflict of interest for Zelikow.
Just to be clear, the preemptive doctrine memo comes out in September of 2002. The commission is created formally in
December 2002.
And do Kane and Hamilton, when they hire Zelikow, are they aware of his role as the author of the preemptive doctrine?
I don't believe so.
These conflicts of interest were not merely theoretical. After the victim's family members discovered Zelikow's links to the Bush administration, he was forced to recuse himself from the proceedings of the commission, which he himself was directing, that had to do with the Bush White House transition or the National Security Council. Hearing of Zelikow's appointment, former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark, who Zelikow helped to demote during the Bush transition, remarked that the fix is in, wondering aloud, could anyone have a more obvious conflict of interest than Zelikow? Key staffers and even one of the commissioners threatened to quit the commission altogether when learning of Zelikow's history. When the 9/11 victims' family members discovered Zelikow's links, they protested his appointment, but unlike with Kissinger, this time their concerns were dismissed, and Zelikow plowed ahead. As even Zelikow himself admits, his ties to the very figures he was supposedly investigating are a legitimate concern, and any real investigation of the 9/11 cover-up would begin with him.
There's a whole welter of conspiracy theories about 9/11 floating around the internet, in video cassettes, and there's a whole cottage industry in this, which if you haven't read much about it, then you're a fortunate person. I get a lot of this. I actually figure very largely in a number of the key conspiracy theories. But to be fair, I worked with Condi Rice, right? I worked with her in the administration of Bush 41. So I could be read as plausible henchmen executing the cover-up. It's a legitimate concern, especially if I hadn't had 81 other staffers keeping their eagle eye on me.
Conveniently left out of Zelikow's story about the 81 staffers keeping their eye on his decisions is that they were staffers who were hired by him and under his complete control. In fact, Zelikow took over the hiring of the commission staff and even stopped staffers from communicating directly with the commissioners themselves. In the first few months, the 9/11 commissioners themselves rarely even visited the commission because Zelikow denied them their own offices or the ability to hire their own staffers. The most remarkable example of Zelikow's dictatorial control came in March 2003, just 3 months after the commission's 16-month investigation began. It was at that time, before the commission had even convened a single hearing, that Zelikow, along with longtime associate and commission consultant Ernest May, co-wrote a complete outline of the final report.
Before the staff even had its first meeting, Zelikow had written, along with his former professor, Ernest May, a detailed outline of the commission's report, complete, as Sheenan put it, with chapter headings, subheadings, and sub-subheadings. When Kane and Hamilton were later shown this outline, they worried that it would be seen as evidence that the report's outcome had been predetermined. So the three of them decided to keep it a secret from the rest of the staff. When the staff did finally learn about this outline a year later, they were alarmed. Some of them circulated a parody entitled The Warren Commission Report, Preemptive Outline. One of its chapter headings read, "Single bullet, we haven't seen the evidence yet, but really, we're sure." The implication was that the crucial chapter in the Zelikow May outline could have been headed, "Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, we haven't seen the evidence yet, but really, we're sure."
So what exactly did Zelikow do as executive director? He allowed information in the commission's final report derived from illegal CIA torture sessions, despite not having access to the evidence of those sessions themselves, which were later illegally destroyed. This included the testimony of alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded 183 times in a single month, whose children were kidnapped by the CIA, who was told that his children were going to be tortured with insects, and who eventually confessed to a whole series of plots, including bombing a bank that didn't exist at the time he was arrested. More than one quarter of the footnotes in the final commission report source from this torture testimony, and as Zelikow himself admitted, quite a bit, if not most, of the commission's information on the 9/11 plot itself came from this testimony. Zelikow denied interviews and documents to staffers investigating the Saudi connection to the attacks, eventually firing one of them and removing the text of their investigation from the final report. He personally rewrote a commission staff statement to suggest a systematic link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq before 9/11, outraging the authors of the original statement. He worked behind his own staffers' back to stop them from serving the Pentagon a subpoena to answer about information NORAD was withholding from the commission. He sat on a proposal to open a criminal investigation into FAA and military officials who lied to the commission for months, and then forwarded that proposal not to the Justice Department, who could have brought criminal charges, but to the Inspector General, who could not. And he covered up information on Able Danger, a military intelligence team that had identified several of the alleged 9/11 hijackers in the country before 9/11.
After the initial disclosure, Dr. Zelikow came to me at the end of the meeting, gave me his card, and said, "What you said today is critically important, very important. Please come see me when you return to Washington, D.C. I returned to Washington, D.C., January of 2004. Call in. They say, "We want to see you. Stand by." Nothing happens. A week goes by. I call again. They say, "We don't need you to come in. We have all the information on Able Danger we need. Thank you anyway." And that was where it ended.
All right. So the information that you told Dr. Zelikow in Afghanistan about the CIA interfering with your ability to provide actionable intelligence to the United States government, intelligence that might have helped them find out who caused 9/11, you were not permitted to testify about.
That's correct.
Okay.
From the initial outline to the final report, Zelikow carefully guided the process, hiring and firing the staff, directing their research efforts, deciding on witnesses, scrubbing information, and shielding his former colleagues in the White House from criticism. But perhaps more remarkable than the fact that the fix was in from the moment he took over the commission and began working on the predictive outline of the final report is that he had in fact written about 9/11 and its eventual aftermath in 1998, 3 years before September 11th. In an article entitled Catastrophic Terrorism, Tackling the New Danger, written for the Council on Foreign Relations Foreign Affairs in November 1998, Zelikow and co-authors Ashton Carter and John Deutsch ask readers to imagine a catastrophic act of terrorism like the destruction of the World Trade Center. Like Pearl Harbor, the event would divide our past and future into a before and after. The United States might respond with draconian measures scaling back civil liberties, allowing wider surveillance of citizens, detention of suspects, and use of deadly force. More violence could follow, either future terrorist attacks or U.S. counterattacks. Belatedly, Americans would judge their leaders negligent for not addressing terrorism more urgently. Zelikow's amazing prediction becomes somewhat less remarkable when we learn his own self-described expertise in the creation and management of public myth. In a separate 1998 article on public myths, Zelikow identifies generational myths that are formed by those pivotal events that become etched in the minds of those who have lived through them, before noting that the current set of public myths, formed during the New Deal in 1933, are currently fading. Convenient for Zelikow, then, that the Pearl Harbor event that would define the next generational myth, known as the War on Terror, would arrive just 3 years later, and that he would be in charge of the commission tasked with creating and managing the public perception of that myth. Indeed, given his central role in the cover-up of 9/11 and deflecting concern away from legitimate 9/11 suspects, any true investigation into the events of September 11th would involve a thorough interrogation of Philip D. Zelikow.
And again, you were just listening to James Corbett of The Corbett Report, sharing two of his reports on 9/11 suspects Rudy Giuliani and Philip Zelikow. To see the videos of these reports, go to CorbettReport.com, and I think they're also on YouTube. And just a reminder that 9/11 wake-up call shows are archived at RadioForAll.net, and that's the digit four, so RadioForAll.net. Once on the site, click on Contributors, and then on Cheryl, under the letter C, and the show should pop up in chronological order. 9/11 Wake Up Call airs at WWUH on Wednesdays at noon and 8 p.m., and on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. at WESU FM. You can also catch the shows by going to noliesradio.org, and they are also intermittently aired at the radio station at Boston College, sometime on Sundays between 6 and 10 a.m. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Right on.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, building bridges.
Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, who's actually banking on the Dakota Access Pipeline?
But now, even before the Dakota Access's pipeline security turned violent, activists faced really harsh responses as Governor Dalrymple declared a state of emergency, removing water and sanitation resources from the reservation, and the police have set up roadblocks around the reservation. Dozens of protesters have already been arrested, and police have spread false rumors of violence from the peaceful protesters.
But as the struggle continues, that it's been an important victory on the legal front, as U.S. District Court Judge Daniel Hovland has dissolved a temporary restraining order against Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Chairman Dave Archambault and other participants in the protest against the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline.
National Lawyer Guild attorney Jeff Haas has retired momentarily from a meeting on the indigenous struggle against the pipeline to preserve native lands and culture and safeguard the environment. And he joins us now to talk about this critical struggle and what the role of lawyers has been in, frankly, the lifting of the federal injunction. Thanks for being with us, Jeff.
Glad to be here.
So where are things now, and what should we know and understand about Judge Daniel Hovland's ruling? How important is it?
I think it was important because I think it was sort of a recognition that the federal courts are not the place to stop these kind of demonstrations, and that he realized he would just be hauling people into federal court who had criminal cases against them, and they'd have the Fifth Amendment right to remain silent, and it would be chaotic and probably would allow another forum for why the water protectors are doing what they're doing. His decision was basically to dissolve the TRO that had been entered against the tribe so that at least people who go out and protest, they may or may not be charged with criminal offenses, but they won't be charged with injunction or contempt of court.
Can state officials do an injunction also, or is this countermand that also?
Well, I guess they could. I don't know that slap suits kind of work if people obediently are doing the same thing every day. But when tactics change and when people lock down on machinery, even though peaceably, I don't think they're going to stop them with a federal suit. And like I said, it might provide another forum. But what they have done is they're increasing the criminal charges here. What was a misdemeanor before has now become a felony, reckless endangerment, so that the bonds are going up and the criminal penalties are going up.
How much are you involved in the day-to-day activity in response to the state of emergency that's been declared, the actual arrest? And I don't know if people are still incarcerated from the arrest. Can you tell us more about actually what has been happening with that?
There have been about over 70 people arrested. Some for actions, some for trespass, some for being press who were covering actions. It's pretty broad, and most recently they've started with these mass arrests. Of course, everybody knows that Jill Stein, there's a warrant out for her, and Amy Goodman, there's a warrant out for her. So they're trying to really chill people from coming, from covering it with the media. So we're just starting to, these dates, arraignment, they're 12, or I think they're 20 arraignments in Mandan, which is the nearest county seat. So getting lawyers through the Lawyers Guild and getting people signed up and getting local lawyers to work on these cases is a lot what we're doing right now.
To what extent is this also now a struggle, a really holistic struggle of more than the Sioux people from that area, but really representative of the entire effort for self-determination of the indigenous peoples of this continent?
The Sioux, it started with the Standing Rock tribe, and immediately I think the seven other Sioux tribes have joined them. But when you go into the camp, there are over almost 200 flags of Native nations who've come in. And when you go there almost daily, a new nation arrives with a bus or with a caravan of cars or with a group of canoes, and they go through this ritualistic acceptance and, can we come to your land? And yes, you're welcome here, and here's a gift. And it's beautiful. It's ceremonial, and it's a lot about indigenous rights everywhere, and everywhere from Alaska and the Northwest and the Cherokees and the Navajo are all here. And I think they realize it is about indigenous rights, and it's about water, and it's about protecting the planet and sacred sites. It's really a conflation of a lot of important issues for Native Americans in particular and their sovereignty rights. But all of us, because I think they're really doing this to save the earth, which they've always had a consciousness about that we haven't.
So aside from defense work, criminal defense work, because of the dozens of protests that have already been arrested and so on, is there any affirmative litigation that looks at challenging the financial institutions that are financing and profiting from the Dakota Access Pipeline, or other kind of creative litigation that may ensue to work towards stopping this pipeline from being installed further?
Well, apparently the D.C. Circuit overruled the district judge in Washington and has granted at least a TRO on 20 miles east and west of the Missouri River or the lake that's adjoining it. So that's pending that appeal. We're also contemplating a suit against these roadblocks because they're stopping people. Local law enforcement is pulling people over for crooked license plates and dirty license plates and looking up arrests and using identification methods to see if people have been in demonstrations. And I think there is an increasing focus on the banks. So almost all the major banks plus two Japanese banks are involved in the financing of this. So there have been demonstrations everywhere. At Bank of America and Wells Fargo and Goldman Sachs. So I think they're becoming an increased target, at least of protesters and of consciousness. And I don't know of a lawsuit yet that's been filed against them, but that's certainly a vulnerable point.
Are the protests as strong now as they were like a week ago or 2 weeks ago? Is things still building?
The mass actions have decreased a little bit. I just got back up here literally about a half an hour ago. So I have to find out. But the determination to stop the building of the pipe and the construction is as strong as ever. And there have been a lot of arrests. People are still going out and still arrested and are sometimes doing this locking down on some of the machinery. And so they go out and find where they're continuing the construction. And yesterday a woman went out to just to video the fact that the pipeline is still being laid west of the Missouri, possibly within the area that they've been enjoined in the D.C. circuit, and she gets arrested for taking a video. So
she probably also had a crooked. She probably was one of the people with the crooked license plate and the dirty license plate. I love that. If that's actually charges that they're leveling, but you know, I'm also wondering about things like environmental impact suits, CEQA suits, and so on. Is that in the cards as an additional support mechanism for the outstanding and rigorous united protests that have emanated from the Standing Rock Sioux tribes?
Well, the slogan here is water is life. And so that's a very fundamental fear here, is that this pipeline will go under the Missouri River and under this lake. I think it's the Waihee, which is where they get, which is where the Standing Rock tribe gets their water source. And the Missouri is the water source for, I think, about 20 million people. So that environmental impact, and also in the tribal resolutions, the fact that this pipeline would bring 500,000 barrels of Bakken oil every day to the Midwest, possibly to the Gulf, And that, I think they said that's equivalent to like adding 20 million cars. So, yeah, that's huge environmental impacts, not to mention just the also the desecration of sacred sites right after an archaeologist identified in D.C. that the, in the direction of the pipeline were these sacred sites and recreations of astronomical bodies that had been done hundreds of years ago. The next day is when they came out and bulldozed that area, and that's the area that we all have seen in the videos where they had the private security guards with dogs.
Jeff Haas, the last time I spoke to you, you were actually out on a hike, and I'm taking that to mean that you take this struggle, aside from the political imperative for your involvement as a National Lawyers Guild lawyer, that you also take it very, very personally, and that it has a deep and profound resonance with you. And I wonder if you can talk about what you think this means to the people of the land, what it certainly means for indigenous culture, but what the indigenous people's efforts here mean to all of us who want to preserve the environment and recognize its profound decimation through these awful organizations of capital, such as Wells Fargo and these other banks that are involved in financing.
That's a really good question. And the other day, you know, I was thinking, and I've been an activist and defended movements going back to the Black Panthers and SDS and the anti-war movements. And so this is another movement where people have come together and taken a stand and put their lives on the line. And that's part of the reason I'm here. But part of the reason I'm here is I'm angry at what they're trying to do to our planet. I have four children and a granddaughter. Their fight, this fight is for all of us. This is not just for indigenous people. What they're trying to protect be our water supply, our environment, prevent this oil from adding to climate change. So I think they're leading the struggle really for all of us involved in environmental issues and water issues and indigenous rights issues. So I do take it personally. And anybody who walks out and wants to hold on to the beauty of the earth should see this as a stand for all of us.
Well, Jeff Haas, I know you have to return to your meeting. I want to thank you for the outstanding work and really decades of work that you've done on people's power issues for the environment, for human and civil rights. You're an outstanding advocate. And thank you for taking a little bit of time tonight to leave your meeting and to educate us and to help continue to build support for our sisters and brothers who are leading the struggle. And I just guess, lastly, do you see any parallel? I mentioned Wounded Knee. Do you think this is kind of in the spirit of Wounded Knee?
I absolutely do. And I think this is the largest gathering of tribes maybe for a century or maybe, who knows, forever. But yeah, it is. And certainly one of the demands here should be and is Free Leonard Pelletier. And I just saw Leonard, who's the defendant, of course, who's still in prison from the Wounded Knee for something he didn't do, a murder that they've admitted he didn't commit. So it's definitely connected. And their AIM, American Indian Movement, people here who were at Wounded Knee. So I thank you for what you said, but it's really an honor and inspiring to be here. And so I look at it, an opportunity to be close to this dramatic stand for all of us.
And thank you for mentioning Brother Leonard Pelletier. Obama, before you leave office, we've got a free Leonard Pelletier. Grant that pardon.
Absolutely.
Thank you so
Absolutely.
Much, and we'll continue to stay in touch and keep our listeners abreast of the issue. We have been speaking with Jeff Haas, National Lawyers Guild lawyer extraordinaire, working for decades for People's Power. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Indian legislation's on the desk of a do-right congressman. Now, he don't know much about the issue, so he picks up the phone and he asks advice of the senator out in Indian country. A darling of the energy companies who are ripping off what's left of the reservations. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They'll send in federal tanks. It isn't nice, but it's reality. Bury my heart.
So we're moving to the next component of looking at the struggle that's been going on against the Standing Rock Sioux people with the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. And as our last guest said, it is reminiscent and it's the largest gathering since certainly Wounded Knee. And Hugh McMillan, senior researcher on water, energy, and climate issues at the Food and Water Watch, you recently wrote the report which states, powerful oil and gas companies are taking appalling steps to override the Sioux Indians' objections, using their immense financial resources to push for building the Dakota Access Pipeline, which will further line their pockets.
Hugh McMillan, who are the companies funding the project, and how are they doing that, and what aspects of the project are they funding?
Well, it's a long list of international banks and U.S. banks, a lot of the household names, Wells Fargo and Citibank, TD Securities. These are banks that are, along with 14 others, are providing the project-level financing, so directly to build Dakota Access, as well as convert a pipeline that would connect the south end of Dakota Access to Texas refineries and export markets. All told, the 38 banks have provided over $10 billion in capital to the Energy Transfer family of companies. Energy Transfer Partners, Sunoco Logistics are the two in that family that are spearheading this Dakota Access Pipeline and the larger Bakken Pipeline project, all the way from near the Canadian border down to the Gulf of Mexico.
It sounds like, you know, and part of your article, it does take me back to Occupy Wall Street and some of the demonstrations there. And, you know, we've got your Goldman Sachs and your Wells Fargo, who is certainly my favorite poster child for despising banks, and Morgan Chase and SunTrust. And I know that there are Japanese companies that are involved in this. What do they get out of it? What's the return, and why so many of these banks and financial institutions? Why are they fostering such widespread drilling? Or is it just these same entities are also throughout the country fostering drilling and fracking to increase our darn disastrous dependent on fossil fuels?
On the financing of Energy Transfer Partners, you can find the details in the list of all the banks at foodandwaterwatch.org. You know, what you'll see with these banks funding Energy Transfer family of companies, it's just a slice of the much larger fracking pie for these banks. As of early this year, just six banks alone, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Citibank, they held over $200 billion in oil and gas industry loans. Working together with oil and gas companies, their front groups, and think tanks, these banks have succeeded in establishing a U.S. energy policy that equates widespread fracking and maximizing production of oil and gas with energy security. Our executive director at Food and Water Watch calls the tangle of interest the frackopoly. And these banks aim to get paid back through widespread drilling and fracking, as you say, for decades to maximize oil and gas production at the expense of targeted communities and the stability of our climate. And, you know, they've succeeded in establishing this policy that equates widespread fracking with energy security and view these investments as very long-term stable investments, fully confident that the United States will extract as much oil and gas as possible in spite of what we know about climate science and the need to keep as much as possible in the ground.
The federal government under Obama recently put a stay on buildings on federal land. What is the significance of that? I mean, will that stop the pipeline, or will the pipeline just go on private lands?
It stopped construction on Army Corps lands surrounding a lake there near the confluence of the Missouri and Kennebaw rivers. So just this small section. And the construction is continuing on private lands. Farmers and landowners are seeing their property rights violated as energy transfer companies and also Enbridge, Marathon, and Phillips 66, which have stakes in this pipeline, are able to exercise eminent domain and force these landowners to have the oil pipeline on their property.
Hugh McMillan, one of the things I'm interested in is politically, how do these financial organizations, they obviously give the money to finance the contractors, et cetera, but what do they also do to assure that they get the kind of permits and cooperation with the politicos to enable them to really rob people of their self-determination, endanger the land, endanger the environment, and so on?
There's certainly a long history of oil and gas companies and their financial backers establishing policies, getting loopholes in environmental laws, getting incentives in the tax code that promote oil and gas extraction, that promote widespread drilling and fracking. You know, think tanks are certainly an interface between the policymakers and the banks and industry. Citibank, for example, they've, along with Goldman Sachs and numerous other banks, are giving money to think tanks that are putting out think pieces promoting oil and gas production in the false name of energy security and energy independence, going so far as to promote the export of domestic oil and gas from fracking in the name of energy independence and energy security.
And this is a pipeline that would end up someplace in Illinois, and then as of now, the oil would be trucked down to refineries probably in the south and near New Orleans. But there's
Energy Transfer Partners has another project. They're converting a gas pipeline to an oil pipeline. And so collectively, the Dakota Access would run 1,100 miles from near the Canadian border down to southern Illinois, where it would connect with this pipeline being converted, and that would run another 700 miles down to Texas. There in southern Illinois, oil from Dakota Access would also be put on trains and sent to the East Coast on what we've come to call bomb trains.
Would that require additional funding, or the $11 billion that you mentioned before that is the banks are pouring in right now for that also?
Right. So the $2.5 billion in direct project level financing to these pipeline companies covers evidently the costs that are remaining for both the Dakota Access Pipeline and the conversion of the gas pipeline that would connect from the south end of Dakota Access on down to the Gulf Coast of Texas, where there are more refineries, and also export infrastructure.
But there's other monies involved also, like $10.5 billion total. So what are those other monies being used for?
Those are going toward the larger program at the Energy Transfer family of companies. So, for example, Energy Transfer is constructing a gas pipeline that's cutting across Big Bend of Texas for export to Mexico, and Energy Transfers has numerous other projects where they're building out infrastructure, sinking these billions of dollars into infrastructure to support more drilling and fracking when we know that that flies in the face of climate science.
You know, one of the things that interested me about doing this piece on the financing structure, the financial institutions and banks, was because for people who cannot make it down to North Dakota, we should begin to think about secondary boycotts, in effect, whether it's withdrawing money from these banks, directly picketing them, putting pressure on their investors, et cetera, to stop allowing for the financing of these fracking and drilling projects. I wonder if you have any additional thoughts from a senior researcher on food, energy, and climate issues at Food and Water Watch as to what we should be thinking about and doing in response, particularly to the Dakota Access Pipeline and these financial institutions.
There's been a number of actions against these banks, and it's served the purpose of spreading the awareness that, you know, it's not just the pipeline companies that are are pushing these projects, but it's the system that's financing these projects. At the same time, it's writing oil and gas and U.S. energy policy. You can take your money out of these banks and put them in community banks, credit unions, and the like, and that will send a message.
Have you heard anything coming out of either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump on this issue?
I've not. It will be interesting to see if Clinton does comment, although it's taken some time. I know that, of course, in the case of Donald Trump, right. His brain on energy is Harold Hamm, who is the CEO of Continental Resources. One publication, DSmog Blog, revealed that he would be expecting, his company is expecting to send significant amounts of oil down the Dakota Access Pipeline.
Just lastly, to be clear, when you have a Citibank and a Wells Fargo and a UBS and a JP Morgan Chase and a Goldman Sachs and a Bank of America and a SunTrust and Credit Suisse, et cetera, and how do all of these entities involved in this financing, how do they actually turn their profit?
They get a return on this investment. So it's the interest plus several percentage points. Considered a stable fixed income for these banks in a multi-decade investment. And that is hinging on the United States extracting as much oil and gas as it can in the coming decades. And that conflicts with what we know about our obligations as we face the urgent crisis of climate change.
In the last moments that we have, Hugh McMillan, how do these companies, these financial institutions and bank, how do they really comport themselves with the powerful oil and gas companies and the steps that they are taking to override the Sioux Indians' objections? What's the primary mechanism, or are there many, that they use to rob the Sioux Indians of their self-determination?
Well, I mean, I think for these banks funding Dakota Access, it's not really registering it as something they're doing. They are just diversifying and funding many, many pipeline infrastructure projects, not just Dakota Access.
Well, Hugh McMillan, where can we get a copy of your report?
At foodandwaterwatch.org.
And there's so many other great things on the Food and Water Watch website. We want to thank Hugh McMillan, Senior Researcher on Water, Energy, and Climate Issues at Food and Water Watch, for the report, for talking to us about these really powerful oil and gas companies that are taking appalling steps to override the Sioux Indians' objections to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
Nays contre
153.
I, Tom.
I, Tom.
Take you, Anthony.
Take you, Anthony.
To be my life partner, my spouse.
To be my life partner, my spouse.
To love and to cherish.
To love and to cherish.
As long as we both shall live.
As long as we both shall live.
To This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Banned U.S. hate preacher diverts South African crusade to Botswana, college sports groups flee anti-LGBT North Carolina, and Canada's queer decade culminates in marriage equality. Those stories and more this week because you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Carol Myers.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending September 17, 2016. A homophobic U.S. hate preacher has been barred from entering both South Africa and the U.K. Stephen Anderson and members of his Faithful Word Baptist Church of Tempe, Arizona, will not be allowed to travel to South Africa because, referencing the nation's Immigration Act, Home Affairs Minister Malusi Gigaba explained that Anderson advocates social violence. The preacher infamously celebrated the June 12th Pulse Massacre in Orlando, Florida, that took the lives of 50 LGBT and queer-friendly souls and injured dozens more, telling his flock that there were now 50 less pedophiles in the world. A petition circulated in South Africa with more than 60,000 signatures called on the government to ban Anderson's entry into the country. It was supported by a bulging dossier on his anti-queer statements and actions, compiled by Gay SA Radio. Anderson has also called on God to rip out Caitlyn Jenner's heart and for the mass execution of gay people to create an AIDS-free world.
Those were apparently more than enough reasons for authorities in the United Kingdom to also display the unwelcome mat for Anderson and his flock. In a YouTube posting, Anderson said that he was originally supposed to take a flight earlier this week to Johannesburg with a connecting stop in London. However, he says, they tell me that the United Kingdom has banned me from entering the country and that not only am I banned from the UK, but I can't even go to the London airport. Since he also can't go to South Africa, Anderson has now set his sights on Botswana, which he called a way more receptive place for his message. LGBT people are challenged in that southern African country by both entrenched societal homophobia and official hostility. But just this year, an appeals court ruled against the government, deciding that an LGBT advocacy group should be allowed to register as an NGO. That rare legal victory hasn't dissuaded Anderson, however. Stand by for reports of multitudes saved in Botswana, he predicted on his Facebook page, where religious freedom still exists.
In the U.S. itself, the National Collegiate Athletic Association, or NCAA, has pulled 7 major national championship events out of North Carolina because of the Tar Heel State's notorious HB2. That law bans LGBT civil rights and requires trans people to use birth certificate-based bathrooms. The NBA announced a few weeks ago that it was relocating professional basketball's 2017 All-Star Game from Charlotte to New Orleans because of HB2. A diverse number of entertainers and organizations are also boycotting the state, and millions of tourism dollars have already been lost. This week's statement from the NCAA's Board of Governors cited the association's commitment to fairness and inclusion and said that NCAA championships and events must promote an inclusive atmosphere for all college athletes, coaches, administrators, and fans. Specifics about where each championship event will relocate have yet to be announced, but they include a National Women's Soccer Championship, the first and second rounds of the men's basketball tournament known as March Madness, a women's golf championship, and men's and women's tennis championships.
One of the major regional collegiate sports associations, the Atlantic Coast Conference, said soon after the NCAA's announcement that it, too, would be yanking its championship games for the upcoming season out of North Carolina because of HB2. The state is losing conference championship games for baseball, women's soccer, football, men's and women's swimming and diving, women's basketball, men's and women's tennis, and men's and women's golf. 15 universities make up the Atlantic Coast Conference, including Clemson, Duke, Florida State, and the University of North Carolina. Losing the conference's football championship game alone, according to some sources, will cost the state an estimated $32 million tourism dollars.
The North Carolina legislature's dominant Republican majority and Governor Pat McCrory, who's locked in a tight reelection campaign, have been under incessant pressure to repeal HB2. For his part, McCrory either doesn't understand or willfully refuses to understand what HB2 does, reducing it just to what he calls a common-sense law requiring people to use appropriate public restrooms. According to a September 16th report in the Charlotte Observer, the North Carolina Restaurant and Lodging Association is trying to broker a deal to end the financial bloodletting. They say McCrory is willing to call state lawmakers into special session to repeal HB2, but only after the Charlotte City Council undoes what prompted the creation of HB2 in the first place and repeal its local anti-discrimination ordinance. The Charlotte ordinance had extended anti-discrimination protections to LGBT people and allowed trans people to use the bathrooms and locker rooms of the gender with which they identify. It's not even clear if there would be enough votes on the Charlotte City Council to overturn the city's LGBT anti-bias protections. A repeal effort in May lost by a vote of 7-4. Mayor Jennifer Roberts has also been an outspoken opponent of HB2. It would take 7 council votes to override what would be her probable veto if Charlotte lawmakers even approve a repeal measure.
In other news, transgender U.S. Army private Chelsea Manning will finally be getting the gender reassignment surgery she's been asking for since her incarceration more than 3 years ago. Then known as Bradley Manning, the former intelligence analyst in Iraq was sentenced in 2013 to 35 years in the brig at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, after a military court convicted her of providing more than 700,000 documents, videos, diplomatic cables, and battlefield accounts to the anti-secrecy group WikiLeaks. The case has been called the biggest breach of classified materials in U.S. history. She's reviled by some as a traitor and celebrated by others as a courageous whistleblower. A deeply depressed Manning was reported in July to have attempted suicide, and last week she announced that she was going on a hunger strike until she got the transition treatment she needed. Happily, the hunger strike ended after 5 days. Manning's ACLU attorneys announced on September 13th that the Army would allow her to receive gender transition surgery that her psychologist had recommended in April. They quoted Manning as saying that, "This is all that I wanted, for them to let me be me." Proudly trans ACLU staff attorney Chase Strangio said in the announcement that while doctors had also recommended that Manning be allowed to follow female hair grooming standards as part of her treatment for gender dysphoria, the government plans to still enforce male hair standards on her. But Manning will become the first transgender U.S. soldier to ever receive reassignment surgery in prison.
In sadder news, 3-time Pulitzer Prize-winning openly gay American playwright Edward Albee has died at the age of 88. His personal assistant reported the passing on September 16th, though no cause of death was immediately announced. As the Associated Press noted, in more than 30 plays, Albee skewered such mainstays of American culture as marriage, child-rearing, religion, and upper-class comforts. He's probably best known for Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the Tony Award-winning play that opened on Broadway in 1962. An Oscar-winning film version starring Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton followed a few years later. The play combined hilarious dark humor and pathos as the lead characters often viciously turn on each other but eventually reconcile. Despite the frequently eviscerating dialogue fit for a queen, Alvey always denied rumors that the two heterosexual couples featured in the play were originally written as gay men.
George and Martha. Sad, sad, sad.
Sculptor Jonathan Thomas, described by the AP as Alvey's longtime companion, died in 2005. I don't like the idea of getting older and older because there's meant to be a time when that has to stop, Alvey said in 2001. Dying strikes me as being a great waste of time.
And finally, the titular star of the long-running Logo TV series RuPaul's Drag Race has won his first Emmy Award. As the outstanding host for a reality or reality competition program, RuPaul Charles bested fellow out celebrities Jane Lynch of Hollywood Game Night and Tim Gunn of Project Runway, in addition to American Idol's Ryan Seacrest and Dancing with the Stars' Tom Bergeron. RuPaul seemed to be genuinely surprised by the win at the Creative Arts Emmy Awards on September 11th. He credited the contestants for the success of his show during a backstage interview with E! Entertainment Television.
This is so special for me because of the 100-plus girls who have so graciously told their stories on our show and who have traveled the world as ambassadors of dancing to the beat of a different drummer. And for young people around the world who see our show in Italy or South Africa or Australia or Japan, who know now that there's a way to navigate this life successfully on your own terms.
RuPaul's Drag Race premiered on Logo in 2009. The series was renewed for a 9th season earlier this year. RuPaul may now rue what he said a few years ago. I'd rather have an enema than have an Emmy.
That's News Wrap for the week ending September 17th, 2016. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm John Dyer V.
And I'm Carol Myers.
Hi, this is Greg Louganis.
I'm Margaret Cho.
This is Edmund White.
Hi, I'm Kate Clinton.
Hello, I'm Armistead Maupin.
I'm Clive Barker.
This is Judy Shepard.
Hello, this is Ian McKellen.
I'm Joey Jewell.
I'm Stephen Fry.
I'm Harvey Milk.
Hi, this is Janice Ian.
My name's Robbie Rogers.
This is Essex Hemphill.
I'm Ellen DeGeneres.
I'm Tab Hunter.
I'm Billy Bean.
This is John Cameron Mitchell.
Hello, I'm Bruce Valange.
This is Bishop Gene Robinson.
I'm Robbie Kaplan.
I'm Andrew Sullivan.
This is Augustine Burroughs.
I'm Barney Frank.
I'm Cleve Jones.
My name is Kate Kendall.
I'm Dan Savage.
Hi, I'm Daryl Stevens. And you've discovered
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
This Way Out.
The international radio show for all our sexually diverse communities.
How dare they?
And those who love them.
Now I'm fascinated.
You ain't gonna get this nowhere else.
And that's the truth.
I moved here in 1990 when I was 17. In 1993, I started a radio show called Queer FM on CITR. I had no idea at the time, but I was about to document one of the most phenomenal decades in the struggle for queer equality, 1995 to 2005. It was the decade we went from no constitutional human rights to full legal marriage.
That's how veteran This Way Out Vancouver correspondent Heather Kitching told her own story in an award-winning CITR documentary, Queer Decade, 1995 to 2005. We've aired her stories about those times the last several weeks, including the legal battles that established LGBT rights, redefined the meaning of spouse, ended censorship by Canadian customs agents, and lifted the bans on queer-positive books in public schools. In this week's romantic conclusion, the movement's engagement ends with a march down the aisle.
Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. Going to the chapel and we're gonna get married. She really loves you and we're...
By 2003, the momentum had shifted in our favor. Courts in Ontario and Quebec had already made same-sex marriage legal, but the rulings wouldn't take effect until July 12, 2004. That was because the court wanted to give governments time to do things like change paperwork and possibly, you know, legalize same-sex divorce, just in case. The litigants in BC were optimistic that our court would rule the same way. This is one of their lawyers, Joe Arve, speaking on the day of the decision.
Thank you for coming to the press conference. We're pleased to report that the British Columbia Court of Appeal, the first court of appeal in Canada, has ruled that the federal common law bar that restricts same-sex couples from marrying is unconstitutional. It was a unanimous decision. It was a definitive decision. It's a decision we're very, very pleased with. So as a practical matter, what this decision means is that gay and lesbians can now marry in Canada, although their right to marry won't be allowed until July 2004.
That press conference took place on May 1st, 2003. On June 10th, the Ontario Court of Appeal ruled that same-sex couples in that province could start marrying immediately. So the BC couples went back to the court and asked for the right to do the same. On July 8th, they were back at the courthouse waiting for that decision. Here's Tim Stevenson.
I'm the first openly gay person who was ordained in any church in Canada, in the United Church of Canada. When I had my own church, and I had one for 4 years in Burnaby before I went into politics, a couple came to me, and this would be, you know, way back in like 1994, 1995. And then they said they wanted to have a marriage ceremony or a blessing. And would I do that? And I said, sure. And then many years later, all of a sudden, I got a call from Tom and Anthony saying that they were in this court procedure and there was a decision that was going to be made. And they wanted me to come if the decision was affirmative from the courts and marry them on the steps of the courthouse immediately after the decision. So I said, sure, I'll do that. Now, by this time, I'm a city councilor in Vancouver. And so we went to the courthouse to wait, and I don't know what time, but the judge made his ruling and said that marriages would be allowed in British Columbia. Huge cheers and so on. And we went outside onto the steps of the courthouse, and there must have been, 100 reporters and cameras. I mean, there it is, totally surrounded. Rather odd kind of way to do a marriage. Didn't feel very religious, you know.
So I'd ask now that you turn and face one another. And Tom, if you would repeat after me. In the presence of God and before these witnesses.
In the presence of God and before these witnesses.
I, Tom.
Take you, Anthony.
To be my life partner, my spouse.
To be my life partner, my spouse.
To have and to hold from this day forward.
To have and to hold from this day forward.
For better, for worse.
For better, for worse.
For richer, for poorer.
For richer, for poorer.
In sickness and in health.
In sickness and in health.
In joy and in sorrow.
In joy and in sorrow.
To love and to cherish.
To love and to cherish.
As long as we both shall live.
Yes, we both.
And now, the regular book says that the man and woman may kiss, the two men may kiss.
Yeah.
Anyway, I did that marriage, and they were married, and that was the first marriage in British Columbia.
For the next next year or so, couples launch court cases in other Canadian provinces and territories, trying to open the door to same-sex marriage in those regions. In all, we racked up 11 court victories in 9 provinces and territories. Meanwhile, the federal government announced it would give up the fight. It would not appeal to the Supreme Court of Canada. Instead, it would draft legislation to legalize same-sex marriage nationwide. It was around this time that a group called Canadians for Equal Marriage really rose to prominence.
My name is Mary Wu Sims, and I'm the former Chief Human Rights Commissioner for British Columbia. Canadians for Equal Marriage was really a broad public interest group that formed out of those fights across the country for relationship recognition and the right to marry, and included at the very beginning EGAL Canada, but then grew to include a whole range of people, including like the PFLAG, the Canadian Labor Congress, Chinese Canadian National Congress, the Canadian Federation of Students. I think having community groups that are not necessarily linked with the GLBT community come out in favor of our right to marry was very, very significant. People from the Sikh community, people from Jewish community, people from various faiths as well as racialized communities come out and speak in favor of equal marriage and why it was important was, I think, one of the huge achievements of the movement.
And that brings us to June 28th, 2005, the day the marriage bill saw its final vote in the House of Commons. Queers in Vancouver were at the Pump Jack Pub watching it on CPAC on the big screen TV.
The question is the following: when Mr. Cotton, seconded by Mr. Peterson, moved that Bill C-38, an act respecting certain aspects of legal capacity for marriage for civil purposes, be now read a third time and do pass. In favor of the motion, will please rise.
The crowd cheered when our supporters stood up to cast their votes. They booed when our opponents voted against us. And then it happened.
I pinch myself. In my lifetime, I've gone from it being a criminal act in Canada to today is huge. We've really achieved so much in such a small period of time.
My name is Murray Corrin. I've been making presentations around issues to do with queer education and queers in the public education system. That decade solidified so many things as far as our rights are concerned, but also in how our community came together to support one another. Demonstration after demonstration, rally after rally around education, around marriage and so on, I think brought us together in ways that really solidified who we are as people. And that makes me very, very proud.
I keep not wanting to be complacent about it and keep reminding ourselves and myself of the struggles that continue by others in our community, those who are Aboriginal, those who are poor, those who are have disabilities. They also need our assistance, so I don't want us to be forgetful of them.
Decade 1995 to 2005 was written and produced by me, Heather Kitching. Madeline Taylor engineered the interviews. Queer Decade uses music composed by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com and licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 3.0. Details are at http://creativecommons.org/licenses/by/3.0. The compositions are called Shades of Spring, Walking Along, Spellbound, Acid Jazz, Chipperdoodle Volume 2, EDM Detection Mode, Ether Disco, Pyro Flow, Danger Storm, Lightness Dawn, Babylon, Son of a Rocket, String Disco, Your Call, and Basement Floor. Queer Decade is a production of CITR Radio and the UBC Centennial Initiatives Fund.
You can follow Heather Kitching on Twitter at Radio Kitching. And if queer history grabs you, come grab this collection.
Attention all LGBT, U.S. history buffs, collectors, and listener supporters.
You can now own a very special edition of This Way Out.
Here's a taste.
Today, being gay is not a crime.
This is going to lead to the legalization of same-sex marriage.
Children born today will grow up in a world without DOMA.
This is social engineering by a court.
Is this Jim?
Yes, it is, Mr. President.
Congratulations.
Today, some of the darkest 24 hours in our nation's history.
It's the day I finally get to look at the man that I love and finally say, will you please marry me?
From outlaws to in-laws traces the legal evolution of the U.S. Supreme Court.
From the decriminalization of private consensual adult gay sex in 2003 to making marriage equality the law of the land in 2015.
This special edition features the voices of dozens of equality advocates over those years who made the journey possible.
Despite always outspoken opposition along the way.
From outlaws to in-laws also includes a wide variety of thematic music.
You'll find all the info you need about this very special edition of This Way Out at
thiswayout.org.
Well, isn't that special?
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Carol Myers, John Dyer V, and Heather Kitching contributed program material, with thanks as always to Steve Pride. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this show possible. Check out the latest program information and a lot more at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on Plains FM, Christchurch, New Zealand, WCRS, Columbus, Ohio, KSOW, College Grove, Oregon, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, I'm Sasha Lilly. 67 years ago, pacifists who had been interned during World War II launched a revolutionary experiment in radio, which remains radical to this day. Richard Moore, Eleanor McKinney, Lewis Hill, and their fellow anarcho-syndicalists first attempted to set up a radio station based out of the working-class city of Richmond, California, with a mission of challenging war and investigating the causes of conflict. The radio station, KPFA, eventually was set up in Berkeley, and its history has paralleled that of much of the left in the second half of the 20th century and beyond, from the repression of the McCarthy period through the upheavals of civil rights, the Black Power, American Indian, women's, and other liberation movements, through the opposition to the Vietnam War and countless other U.S. interventions around the world, from Central America to the Middle East, to recent movements such as Occupy and the movement for Black Lives. Today, we're going to celebrate KPFA's history by featuring some highlights from our past as a way to ensure our future. We'll hear from the likes of groundbreaking Palestinian scholar Edward Said, actor Jane Fonda, journalist Molly Ivins, and writer Gore Vidal in conversation with Christopher Hitchens. This is the last day that KPFA, that Against the Grain, will come to you during this fund drive, and we hope you'll support us with your financial donation. We'll be offering almost 67 hours of audio from KPFA's history and playing some highlights from that history, starting with an interview that KPFA's Elsa Knight Thompson did with James Farmer, leader of the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE. Let's take a listen from that conversation to start off with.
Mr. Farmer, I believe you are the first national director of CORE. At least I don't remember any previous person with this title. Could you tell me something about your post?
Yes, well, this is the first time that CORE has had a national director. The office was reorganized. You see, within the past year and a half, CORE has undergone a great growth, largely as a result of the student sit-in movement in the South. And because of that growth, it was necessary to consider the organizational problems of the outfit. And as a result, we set up new titles, new divisions of responsibilities. And I was invited to join the staff as national director.
How long has CORE been in existence now?
Well, CORE was founded in 1942 in Chicago, so it's 19 years old.
And how many branches have you now?
We have 50 local chapters scattered throughout the country.
Well, isn't that a pretty rapid growth? It seems to me that it wasn't anywhere nearly that many not too long ago.
Oh, yes. Within the past 2 years, most of CORE's growth has taken place. I would say that when CORE was founded back in 1942, Mrs. Thompson, nonviolence was not very well known, not well respected, and there had been very little experimentation along those lines. However, in 1956, with the Montgomery bus boycott in Alabama under the leadership of Martin Luther King, nonviolence came much more into prominence. And it was then that CORE's great growth began, and that growth was even more accelerated by the Southern Student Sit-In Movement, which began a year ago, February.
I believe you have just been involved in this cross-country bus ride. Now, I'm sorry to admit that I haven't really had time to follow up this story, and you can begin at the beginning and tell me what it the purpose was and how many people were involved and so on.
Well, very gladly, Ms. Thompson. Of course, Freedom Ride is now a part of American history. And I think that all persons in the country, all citizens, should be aware of it. You see, back in 1946, the United States Supreme Court, in the Irene Morgan case, ruled that there could be no segregation of interstate passengers on buses. More recently, in 1960, the Supreme Court ruled in the Boynton case that there must be no discrimination or segregation of interstate passengers in any of the facilities at bus terminals. It was therefore following up on these two rulings that CORE decided upon its Freedom Ride, whereby an interracial group from all over the country, at least half of them being from the South, would travel as interstate passengers by regular interstate carriers, Greyhound and Trailways, through the South, including the Deep South, refusing to submit to the local customs of segregation, seeking unsegregated seating on buses, seeking use of all the bus terminal and rest stop facilities en route, including the waiting rooms, the lunch counters, restaurants, washrooms, and so forth.
And that is James Farmer speaking with KPFA's Public Affairs Director, Elsa Knight Thompson. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. We're now going to go to a conversation that was organized by KPFA's Bob Baldock. It took place on March 11th, 1998, a conversation between the novelist, essayist, screenwriter, actor, and critic Gore Vidal, who died in 2012, with Christopher Hitchens, the writer and critic. And this event was one of many that have been organized by KPFA's Bob Baldock, part of KPFA's Storied Past, and we're going to play some edited excerpts from their discussion.
One of the things that has saddened me in my life, one is I have no gift for science, but the fact that we only have two lobes to our brains. So we are binary thinkers. That's why we always think yes or no. Well, that's just too dumb. That's too simple. Up or down, black or white. We had three lobes, we might have a third thing in there, you know, up and down, and the other one. I'm after the other one.
You make it sound oddly saucy, or is that just me?
I think you're trying to bring this thing up, you know, to give urgency.
I noticed in Kirkus reviews that you'd achieved a new status. I don't know if you noticed it, but you were described as curmudgeon and sage. Now, I know perhaps some of you have noticed this too, that the consensus in this culture has a wonderful way of dealing with anyone who dissents, all the terms used to describe it are terms of condescension and patronization. If you're young, you might be described as a gadfly, for example, or a bad boy, very condescending. If you live a little longer, maybe a maverick. Then sometimes equally condescending words like irreverent, for example, or provocative. If you're very, very good, iconoclastic. And then if you stagger over the line, curmudgeon and sage. What do you reckon?
And finally, the killer. Ironic.
Ironic.
Well, I've been called so much, I don't have much memory of it anymore. But they don't forgive. I mean, places like the New York Times, once they decide you're bad news, you are bad news for all time. And I feel honored, you know, that they have never let up in 50 years.
What was it they said about your first novel, about City, not your first, but about City and the Pillar?
In those days, there weren't no favorable books about same sexuality as of 1948, but this was pretty much so. A real adjective there was sterile. This is a sterile book, which makes you think, it's a fertile book, you know, I mean, two books mating all over the place.
Or appropriative book.
Yeah, pamphlets emerging from them, and I was called sterile for years and years, and no matter what I wrote about, it was always supposed to be the same subject. I'd be writing about politics, history, elegant, sterile. And, they stay on the case, you know, and they expect you to go away, and then when you don't, I'm waiting for them to go away. Problem, their numbers are not all that good, I'm told.
I still find it slightly strange that you, who saw the Kennedys up that close and for that long, could be so insouciant about what we now call the character question.
Well, I don't think sex has anything to do with character.
You don't?
No.
Well, they don't either. I wonder what their characters are like.
Well, if it's consenting between two adults, it is of no one's business. It's amazing how little men of power actually think about it. Kennedy, I maintain a lot of his activity was that he was so full of drugs from his doctors and his witch doctor that he had to get rid of it somehow, and once a day he would get rid of it that way. I mean, he had a great desire to purge himself all the time, and now mind you, in a country that has made heterosexuality compulsory, you are going to have some oddballs, you know, particularly in the White House. And we just have to be tolerant. So the president likes interns. Well, it could be worse, you know.
But doesn't it also raise a question of national security? I mean, if you're going to have heterosexuals now going to be in top key positions, I mean, can they be trusted, do you think?
Well, look, you take a risk with a heterosexual every time. You take a risk. Only homosexuals know how to keep secrets. The others just blabber, you know. They go on Barbara Walters and tell her everything. So I think there's an element of risk. You're quite right. But we'll take our chances. We must be tolerant.
Staying with family values just for a second, then. You also have a connection on another side and another branch to the Orking classes and the Kennedys, as all know. And I remember you once described Edward Kennedy, the senator, the senior senator from Massachusetts, almost languorously. I remember you describing him as possessing all the charm of 300 pounds of condemned veal. And I remember thinking that...
This was Chappaquiddick time.
But I remember thinking...
Oh, I heard the most awful, sick joke.
Oh, please. I'll cover my microphone if you'll cover yours.
It's simply awful. One of the sisters, Eunice or Jean or one of them, rang up Rose, who was on her very last legs, to tell her that Jackie was dead. And Rose said, who? I said, Jackie. Who? Jackie, you know, Jack's wife, the widow, she's dead. Oh, dead? Was Teddy driving?
What, if it comes to that...
Don't tell anyone.
No,
I
would not
worry.
Because if it comes
I know I can trust you.
And an edited excerpt from a conversation between the late Gore Vidal and Christopher Hitchens that was organized by KPFA. You're listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. And I want to let you know that what we're doing today is playing some highlights from different luminaries, thinkers, writers who have been given a platform by KPFA over the last 67 years. And as a thank you gift for your support to KPFA, and in fact, what we're asking you to do is allow us to continue into the future so that this platform will continue for future artists, writers, intellectuals, and thinkers, we're asking you to pledge your support, and we would love to send you on a USB drive our collection, 67 Years, 67 Voices, for a $250 pledge to KPFA. So it's 67 different talks or conversations by, well, I'll give you a few sense of the range. It's enormous. But by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or going to kpfa.org, you can get 67 Years, 67 Voices. It includes the likes of, and this is just scratching the surface, the poet Langston Hughes, Noam Chomsky, Dylan Thomas, Murray Bookchin, Bernardo Bertolucci, the great filmmaker, Paul Robeson, Alan Watts. If you've been listening to Alan Watts over the last few days, there's Alan Watts is included in this. The poet June Jordan, Dolores Huerta, Betty Davis, the actor, Germaine Greer, the feminist, the Iran-Contra hearings, which garnered KPFA awards, Edward Said, who in fact we're going to listen to a bit later on in the program, the Winter Soldier broadcasts of veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan 2008, our soldiers coming back, Steven Spender, J. Robert Oppenheimer, Cesar Chavez, Lena Horne is in here, the jazz musician, Francis Ford Coppola, the director, Rebecca Solnit, Aaron Dottie Roy, the list is just, Richard Wolff is in here, Pete Seeger, the list is just incredibly long. That's just a fraction of what you can get for your mere $250 pledge to KPFA. So to celebrate our 67 years and to send us off into 67 more, we're asking you to pick up your phone right now and call 1-800-439-5732 or go to kpfa.org and pledge there. Pledge what you can. I'm going to be playing a number of different highlights during this hour, which can really only, it doesn't do justice to this collection at all. We're just scratching the surface in a tiny way of the breadth of what KPFA has brought to the airwaves. And the thinkers and leaders and activists who really have not had a place elsewhere and should have. And so if that seems like a worthy project to support, then please support us right now. 1-800-439-5732. Easy to remember as 1-800-HEY-KPFA, or you can pledge at kpfa.org, which is a very affordable for us way of taking your pledge. It's the cheapest way of all. We're now going to turn to the columnist and author Molly Ivins, who died in 2007. This was a talk that she gave 3 years prior, and let's take a listen to that.
Now, I have thought about it, and it's always hard when I haven't been here for a while for me to remember what Berkeley is like. And Usually what I do is go around saying to discouraged liberals in various places like Fritters, Alabama, that they need to cheer up. And it occurs to me that maybe you all don't need that as much. But then I thought about your governor and realized that indeed you could use some cheering. And oh, sorry about making the obvious point. One reason you should feel better right away is because you don't have to be in Texas. Our governor is a guy named Good Hair Perry. That man has a head of hair every Texan can be proud of, regardless of party. A couple of summers ago, Good Hair needed to appoint a new member of the Public Utilities Commission. As y'all remember here and know very well here in California, that can turn out to be a critical public body. So Good Hair selected for this purpose a former Enron executive. The next day, Good Hair got a $25,000 check from Ken Lay. Those with suspicious minds thought there might be a connection. Good Hair was forced to hold a press conference where he explained to everybody's total satisfaction that it was completely coincidental. Now, in Texas, we do not have a sunshine law. We have sort of a partly cloudy law. But even in Texas, if you get a major state appointment like that, you have to fill out a bunch of forms and you know, all your finances, and all this becomes part of the public record. So the Enron executive's forms showed up a couple of days later. Some minion from the governor's office brought them around to the press room where the alert guardian watchdogs of democracy were in action. Well, I started looking at the form, and somebody says, I don't know, you think 17 looks funny? Gee, I don't know, Sam, you think 17 looks funny? We all thought 17 looked funny. That was the question you have to answer about whether or not you've ever had any unfortunate involvement with law enforcement authorities. The governor's office had whited out the answers to question 17. This was a very sophisticated cover-up. We in the press corps are hard to fool. We were on the trail and discovered in no time flat that the citizen had had a couple of minor brushes with minor traffic violations. And also, while out hunting the year before, he had accidentally shot a whooping crane. And then he accidentally buried the whooping crane. I'm not making this up. And as a result, I had to pay a $15,000 fine under what in Texas is known as the Endangered Species Law. And we all thought that was damn stiff. And we put all this in the newspapers, and of course, Texas is full of hunters. And their reaction was, well, hell, anybody could accidentally hit a whooper. But we stayed on the story, and the next day we were able to report that he hit the whooper while on a duck hunt. Now, we got a whole staple of hunters. Now, you know, the whooping crane is 5 feet tall. It's a very large bird. The duck. Now we got a whole staple of hunters saying, you know, if this sumbitch too dumb to steal a whooper from a duck, he shouldn't be running state utilities. To resign. My friends, progress can be made in many different and wonderful ways. Now, the great excitement at home, of course, is we've just had some political indictments, and three of the top fundraisers for Tom DeLay were all indicted. But they were indicted for breaking Texas campaign finance laws. You have to understand the magnitude of that achievement. We don't have any campaign finance laws in Texas. I mean, you really have to work at it to get indicted for that. And so we're all real proud of them. And we think this case may eventually lead to other indictments. And among those prominently mentioned in the indictable category is the incumbent Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, a fellow named Tom Craddock. Now, I don't have anything against Tom Craddock personally. I don't like his politics, but I don't wish him ill. However, I am rooting for his indictment just as a matter of Texas political tradition. Should Craddock be indicted, that would make 6 out of the last 7 House speakers indicted for one thing or another. Now, there was one in that 6, I have to admit, who kind of broke the string. He was not indicted. He was the one who was shot to death by his wife. She was indicted but not convicted. Because in Texas, we recognize public service when we see it. Now, here we are in the year of our Lord, 2004, faced with a really exciting presidential campaign. And I know that the stunning charisma of both candidates just has people agog. Bush was in the Midwest 2 months ago, and he had a private meeting with leaders of the Amish community there, and he told the Amish that God speaks through him. I myself thought the Lord knew how to pronounce nuclear, so I was a little surprised. But as I watched that first debate with John Kerry, it became clear to me that that was not God speaking. He's much more articulate. What we had was another case of a Lord impersonator. This happens all the time in Texas. People are always thinking that God told them to do something. And a couple of years ago, a bunch of people in Levelland said that God told them to take off their clothes, get in a GTO, and drive to Louisiana. Which they did. 17 naked people in a GTO. They got to Vinton, Louisiana, and ran into a tree. The Vinton cops said that seeing 17 naked people pile out of one car was really amazing. That was not God that told those people to do it. It's that fellow who runs around impersonating the Lord, and that's clearly who Bush has been listening to. That is a story I know I've told before, but I think I've got a new audience, mostly new audience. Isn't that wonderful? John Henry Falk always said, you don't need new stories, you just need a new audience. Was a few years back, the Texas legislature took a fit of communism and decided to make Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday a state holiday. Now, don't worry. It was a package deal. We kept Confederate Heroes Day. Nevertheless, the legislature recognizing Dr. King's birthday, it naturally upset the Ku Klux Klan. And they announced they were coming to Austin to have a big protest and rally at the Capitol. And, you know, it's always discouraging when the Klan comes to visit. The black citizens get upset, the Jewish citizens get upset, the skinhead kids turn out to cheer for them. Everybody's mad at everybody for 6 months. Fist fights on the sidewalk. Just awful. And of course, as a civil libertarian, there you are, standing up for the right of these blue-bellied nincompoops to spew whatever vicious drivel they want to, because it's in the goddamn First Amendment. It's free speech. And that is a stand that will make you about as popular as a whore trying to get into the SMU School of Theology. You are not going to make a bunch of friends sticking up for the Klan's right to free speech, let me tell you. Did Mario Savio ever had to deal with this kind of thing, I ask you? Well, we have to deal with it a fair amount, and so we fall back on our resources. And we fell mournfully, gathered over a pitcher of beer, and came up with a better plan. Now, we don't have enough cluckers in Austin to have a good march. They had to be bussed in from Waco and Vidor. Got off the buses wearing their little pointy hats on their little pointy heads, and started marching up Congress Avenue toward the state capitol. They were greeted by several thousand citizens of Austin who mooned them as they marched. made a real nice effect. It was kind of like a wave in a baseball stadium. But I do think that having a good time while you're doing this is critical to A, getting it done, and B, staying sane.
A little advice from the late journalist Molly Ibens, speaking in Berkeley at a KPFA event. You're listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm playing some highlights from a collection that was put together celebrating the last 67 years of KPFA. It's called 67 Years, 67 Voices, and within it, and you can get it on a USB drive, you just stick it into your computer, It encompasses an incredible range of people, from Frank Zappa to Muhammad Ali to Mary McPartland, Naomi Klein, Paul Krasner, Anais Nin, Mario Savio, George Galloway, the jazz singer Carmen McRae is in here, Norman Mailer's in here, Harvey Milk's in the collection. It is just mind-bending. Akira Kurosawa, the director's in this, Rosa Parks, a real reminder, but encapsulation of so much of the vibrancy of the left since KPFA was founded in the late 1940s, and the great cultural and intellectual richness that has accompanied the left in so many ways. And I would love to be able to have send to you, or have the station send to you, that is, this collection for your support of KPFA, because there's really no better way to support us than to think about the work that we've done and make a decision for yourself of whether you would like to see it continue. And I have to say that really sadly, our situation is much more precarious than I have ever seen it. And the future of the station actually does genuinely hang in the balance. So if you think that KPFA matters, this is really the time to support us by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or go to kpfa.org. You can get the 67 Years, 67 Voices collection on a little USB drive. You can just pop it into your computer, a $250 pledge. Also, if you would like to help us out in a very big way, maybe think about getting the Against the Grain Super Pack, which combines this collection and a number of the most popular things we've offered on Against the Grain during this fund drive. So you get the 67 Years, 67 Voices. You get the Untold History of the United States, which is the Oliver Stone 12-part, 12-hour documentary set. You get the series Capitalism on 5 DVDs, and the Alan Watts library collection, which is 28 hours of Alan Watts. All of those for a $750 pledge to KPFA. And if you would like to just pledge whatever amount you can afford and not get a thank you gift, that would be wonderful too. I'd encourage you to go to kpfa.org to do that. You could also do it by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. And as an extra incentive, we have been challenged $400 by two listeners, Rosario in San Jose and John in Visalia, who are saying that collectively they will match you dollar for dollar up to $400 if you pledge right now. So I'm hoping you'll step forward and pledge and get this thank you gift, 67 Years, 67 Voices, or the Against the Grain Super Pack, or as I say, the premium-less version, that is, just say, all I want is that KPFA continues, and I am knowing that my pledge is tax-deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. I'm going to take a little bit of a risk here and just go back to some more audio from this collection with the hope that you know that this challenge is on the line, $400, and that you will go to your phones or to your computer and pledge as the audio is rolling. We do need to be able to make this match, so it's definitely a bit of leap of faith that I'm making, but I'm hoping that that is something that I will not regret, because there is one of the talks included in this collection, 67 Years, 67 Voices, is that given by the late Edward Said, the great Palestinian scholar theorist of Orientalism. He, not long before he died, gave a talk in Berkeley just before the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And I took this cut in particular because I thought it was so prescient in terms of seeing into the future what was unfolding and his conclusions that he draws about the importance of ideas. So let's take a listen to Edward Said now.
This is a very fraught moment to be speaking about human rights in the Middle East and those of the Palestinian people in particular. But it does seem to be in some ways a symbolically useful time for the purposes of my lecture. The United States of America has already sent a hugely intimidating military force to various Arab and non-Arab countries in the region surrounding Iraq. The frankly imperial idea behind that is, on one level at least, to disarm Iraq forcibly and also to change its dreadful regime. The rest of the international community, not least among them the Arab countries of the region, as well as some of the other permanent members of the Security Council, has been expressing varying degrees of disquiet and occasionally of urgent disapproval. Although it's also clear that most Arab governments are too unpopular and intimidated to do anything but go along. Certainly it's the case that no one outside Iraq has suggested any concern, any iota of concern about Saddam Hussein and his government. It is the people of Iraq who stand to suffer the most and whose doubly and triply miserable fate is of the deepest interest to people all over the world, although you wouldn't know it from the American media. I'm sorry to say that none of this has had the slightest effect on what is an impervious, not to say granitic, will on the part of a tiny number of members of George Bush's administrations who plan to go forward with a war, among whose stated intentions is the unilateral wish to bring American-style democracy to Iraq and the Arab world, redrawing maps, overturning governments and states and modes of life on a fantastically wide scale in the process. That all this has very little to do with the enhancements of human rights in a part of the world especially rife with their abuse, in my opinion, is patently obvious. Were Iraq to have been the world's largest exporter of oranges, there would have been no concern over its purported possession of weapons of mass destruction or its extraordinarily cruel and tyrannical regime. This is a war planned for resources and for strategic control. And whether or not it occurs, there is still some small room for doubt about that, given the huge number of protests all over the world, a deeply encouraging sign. The U.S. The U.S., or its government, has at very least asserted its strategic dominance over the center of the world's largest known energy reserves, from the Gulf to the Caspian Sea, and plans to reshape the area by pacifying threats to its dominance in countries like Syria, Iran, and some of the Gulf Emirates. To threaten war with such belligerence and such a wasteful deployment of military resources is an abuse of human tolerance and human values. That it might in the end turn out to be only a display rather than actual use of force only deepens anxiety about the kind of world we are moving toward. Note also that by the end of the decade, China will be importing as much oil as the United States, and by 2025, the United States will need to import a full 75% of its oil needs from the Gulf region in particular. As against those mighty facts, whether people are prevented from getting an education or from being allowed to move, express themselves, and organize freely without fear either of intimidation, collective punishment, or assassination, may seem therefore like relatively humdrum, if not entirely trivial, issues. that they do pertain with a frightening parallelism to both the people of Palestine and the people of Iraq. In either and both cases, my point here is to assert the universal applicability of human rights to those unfortunate people, given that since World War II, there has grown up an impressive, even formidable, worldwide consensus that each individual or collectivity, no matter his or her color, ethnicity, religion, or culture, is to be protected from such horrific practices as starvation, torture, the forced transfer of populations, religious discrimination, humiliation, extrajudicial political assassinations, land expropriation, and all manner of similar cruel and unusual punishment. I want to affirm also that no power, no matter how special or how developed or how strong or how urgent its claims of past victimization and present mission, is exempt from accusation and judgment if that government practices such things. And finally, no people or individuals can be singled out as exceptions to these general rules so as to be considered, in fact, liable for such abrogations of human rights as those I've mentioned. We live in a secular historical world. History is the product of human labor, choice, and will. Nothing transcendental or divine can supersede that truth or suspend the consequences that flow from its application. There simply is no convincing way to assert special claims whose origin is divine edict, claims that supposedly legitimate high-altitude or smart bombing, or the use of 60-ton bulldozers to demolish the houses of poor and defenseless people who don't happen to belong to the correct religion or race. Just as I feel as an American that the United States has not been divinely endowed with a special errand into the wilderness, despite what George Bush says, and that its practices are endorsed by God, which I don't believe, I feel it is our moral and intellectual duty to oppose the unjust use of its immense military, economic, and political power abroad for what the George Bush administration claims falsely to be its national security interests. I have no power, so I must resort to the tools of education, to writing and speaking. By the same token, I want to reiterate my conviction here that the specific case of the denial of the human rights of the Palestinian people by the State of Israel, supported by the United States, cannot at all be justified on any of the grounds routinely accepted by far too many individuals and governments who would be the first to object to similar behavior in other cases. So far from Israel and the Palestinians being a special case of unusual and exceptional circumstances, I think the exact opposite is true, that because Palestine is perhaps of all places on earth the one most densely saturated with cultural and religious significance, precisely that reality makes it an instance of universality thwarted and flouted, the universality of human coexistence, human acceptance of the other, and human construction of a just and fair society for all, and certainly not only some of its residents. The point is that no state at all is, in my opinion, entitled legitimately to object to these formulations. And certainly no leader can state unarguably, for example, as George Bush has, that the United States is good and its enemies evil, or as General Sharon has announced, and I quote now, that we are placing no restrictions on our operations in the Palestinian territories. Israel is under no pressure. No one is criticizing us, he says, or has the right to do so. End of quote. I would submit that such sweeping statements of higher purpose and extraordinary impunity must be opposed and intellectually dismantled for the thuggish balderdash that such pronouncements really are.
especially if they're intended to cover or explain or excuse or somehow justify barbaric devastation and vast ruin.
The late Edward Said, oh, how we miss him, speaking at a KPFA event. I'm Sasha Lilly, alongside C.S. Song. This is Against the Grain, and in fact, this is the last Against the Grain that's going to come to you during this fund drive. So in the 11 minutes we have left, this is our last chance to register support from you, and we hope get your shows of support from your hard-earned dollars by calling 1-800-439-5732, 1-800-439-5732, or kpfa.org. We are really, really pleased to be able to offer you a most fabulous thank you gift today, which is really just a little slice of KPFA. It is on a USB drive, 67 years, 67 voices, a collection that for $250 celebrates just some of the highlights of the luminaries, the thinkers, the artists, the writers, and the social movements that have found a home and have been given a platform, often for them, people who labor in the wilderness elsewhere, have been given a platform for their ideas here at KPFA. And we are hoping that you will help us into the future by pledging right now, pledging your support, 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We did make the match, I want to say, and thank you.
Thank you.
Those of you who have called and pledged, but we have still a steep hill to climb before this hour ends in terms of how much money we need to raise. So I want to appeal to you. If you are able to give the as much as you can on this final day, we would be so grateful. And if that amount is $250 for the USB drive, 67 years, 67 voices, that would be wonderful. However, if you can afford to give at the $750 rate, you get that USB drive along with the Alan Watts Library Collection, 28 Hours of Alan Watts that you may have heard parts from yesterday, the Oliver Stone DVD series, The Untold History of the United States, and the Capitalism series on DVD, which you also may have heard here on Against the Grain. All of those for a $750 pledge. But really, of course, what we're trying to do here is raise the maximum amount of money to have the ultimate thank you gift continue. And that is this place, this station, KPFA. I mean, when you think of Edward Said, he was a towering figure, a towering thinker, intellectual. I mean, when he says we need to intellectually dismantle something, those are words you don't take lightly from Edward Said. He was incredibly talented, and yet he was someone who did not have a place to put his ideas forward, was reviled and, you know, constantly hounded because of his speaking out for the Palestinians, of which he was one. And KPFA was a home for him. And if that is something that you think is important, I mean, just this recent controversy at UC Berkeley, where the university, at the result of pressure from Zionist groups, it canceled a class about Israel-Palestine because it used the term settler colonialism, fortunately reinstated after there was a whole lot of upheaval within the university. But these kinds of things are real. They're everywhere. If you take ideas seriously, ideas are constantly being attacked. Having a place for critical ideas on the left is something you can never, ever take for granted. So please step forward and do what you can to allow this platform, this place, to continue. That is KPFA, and that is Against the Grain. 1-800-439-5732. That's 1-800-HEY-KPFA or kpfa.org. And I should say that if you would like to get the USB drive, you will have to call 1-800-439-5732, because I do not see it up on kpfa.org right now. But kpfa.org is a wonderful place just to make a donation without a premium, or to choose other premiums that you would like. And one more thing, if the reasons I've given haven't been incentive enough, maybe this will give you the reason to call us right now. We have two generous listeners who together have put up a $1,000 challenge for us. If we can make the equivalent amount before the hour ends, and the minutes are ticking away, the end of the hour is looming. We have less than 7 minutes to go. $1,000 on the line. So won't you support us right now? CSNI, see the calls coming in. We see the pledges coming online, and we know that you've taken a stand for us, and we are so grateful. 1-800-439-5732 or kpfa.org.
So every dollar you give is doubled. It's doubled because we are in a matching period. It's the last matching period of the time that Sasha and I will come to you. As she said, this fund drive, it ends on Friday. So if you've been waiting, if you've been hemming, if you've been hawing, if you've been thinking about it, if you've been considering, we urge you to take action now and get this. This is more than 60 hours, folks, more than 60 hours of really some of the great thinkers and activists and artists of our time and before our time. And if you're a little bit older, you will identify with so many of these voices. And if you are a little younger, you will get such rich history, history of the left, history of radical movements, history of radical thinking, history of avant-garde art and literature. This is such a rich collection, 60 hours on a USB drive, $250. You can break it down into six equal monthly installments, like you can break down almost any pledge you make to KPFA. You can break it down into six installments. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. And as Sasha mentioned, we have this amazing super pack, which includes the USB drive, 67 years, 60 voices, plus the Alan Watts library collection, which is so popular with listeners, as well as the Untold History of the United States, the Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick series, as well as the Capitalism series. That is an amazing compilation, and it's deeply discounted so that we can make everything together available to you for a $750 one-year pledge to KPFA. Think about whether you can do that. Think about whether you can give $250. Think about whether you want any thank you gift that's been offered on Against the Grain, this fund drive. Now's your time to vote for the program. Now's your time to say yes to the program. 1-800-439-KPFA. 1-800-439-KPFA. And I, as I've liked to say recently, because it really is a thought sincerely that I express sincerely and honestly, do it not for us. If you don't want to do it for us, do it for yourself. Do it for the education. Do it for the inspiration. Do it for the humor. Who doesn't want more Molly Ivins in their lives or Gore Vidal? Do it for yourself. Do it for your own growth and development and education. Do it for your own actualization. Do it because what you get in return, not just on KPFA, but on any of the thank you gifts we are offering this hour, any gift we've offered this fund drive, you get so much. And you might acknowledge after you consume, I hate that word actually now because of the word consumer, but after you take in all this information, you will, I bet you will say, well, that was more than worth it. That was more than I actually gave to KPFA. I got more than I gave. 1-800-439-KPFA. 1-800-439-5732. And, you know, as Sasha was saying, give now. Your dollars are doubled, but that's going to end in 3.5 minutes.
Yes, please call right now, 1-800-439-5732, and give as generously as you can. I want to thank some people who have called and pledged so far. Elizabeth Brown in Kensington, thank you so much. Dietje Bowler in San Francisco, I hope I'm saying your name right. We're very grateful to you. Blaine Bergstrom in San Jose, Nancy Gillard Bartles in Chico, and Mary Fiddler in Oakland, thank you all so much for your generous pledges. We also had a pledge come in from Newton, Kansas. Thank you.
Whoa.
For that. And the listener, Ellen O'Toole, wrote online, I love Against the Grain and would hate to see it go off the air. And she also likes Richard Wolff. Well, we I guess we concur with that and hope that you will do your part to make sure that doesn't happen. Because right now your dollars are doubled. And, of course, your donations are tax deductible to the fullest extent allowed by law. It's really a wonderful way to divert some of your money away from the military and to this institution founded more than 67 years ago by pacifists, but just because this institution has been here as long as it has, and it's remarkable that it has managed to weather the storms of the last decades, there is no guarantee that we can continue into the future without your help. These are really dire times for us. So if you were thinking about supporting a range of things and you're wondering which one to balance, well, I guess I would make the argument that KPFA particularly needs you, and that the support that you give to us has a sort of multiplier effect that one can give to all sorts of single issues or different causes. But when you give to KPFA, in effect, you are supporting an institution, supporting a mechanism that actually is a way of shining the light on a huge range of causes. So it is, I think, a very, very worthy one. I hope you agree. And but we have $1,000 on the line. So far, we have not gotten close enough to making the match. We've got a bit over a minute left. Won't you be the person who puts us over the top? If you can afford to get the super PAC for $750, that would be wonderful. If a $1,000 pledge would be wonderful, and a $100 or $25 pledge would be wonderful. Whatever you can give, this is really the moment for us, especially if you feel like you're a hardcore against the grain fan. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. We've got 45 seconds left to go. We need to be able to make this match. Won't you join us?
Yeah, you can do it. You can help us over the top. 1-800-439-5732. We hear a lot from people saying, you know, against the grain is the greatest. And, you know, you guys are doing something that no one else is doing. It's an amazing in-depth analysis program. You know, words are great, but money at this point and resources are what actually make this program work and able to continue. We're appealing to you now. We've got 10 seconds left. 1-800-HEY-KPFA.
And I don't know if we made that match. Please keep calling and pledging, and thank you all who've pledged so far.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.